Thank you, folks, for being here. Thank you, committee members, for being here and be prepared to work on some very important issues. During the early part of the session, I was chair of the budget division, and we worked very carefully with our group in order to do a lot of good work, I think, and we're now coming to another stage, try to coordinate the judiciary budget division materials to this committee and ultimately to the governor. We have a relatively small, if you will, group here, and what I'm talking about is in the number of people, the amount of money that fits into this group or not, and we have a number of things that will be covered this afternoon. We're basically going to look at the courts, the public defenders, the civil legal service, and tax court, uniform law commission, and the Board of Judicial Standards. And then there's a special item on the Hennepin County that are correcting an error that we had some time back. Looking at this, the main pieces of this budget base are focused on the courts, the public defender, and the civil legal service, and the others will not. So having done that, I now would like to have Chris Turner take up the spreadsheet and tell us where we are.
Okay. Mr. Turner and members, what I'm going to do, what I would like to do first is just to summarize this spreadsheet, because I mean, the spreadsheet's confusing. There's about three people in the state who understand it. So I'm just going to go over what the increase over the base was for the Senate, the governor, and the House in the judiciary. The governor went. The governor's recommendation was $140 million over base for the entire public safety bill. But as you know, the Senate public safety bill was split into three bills. Your bill, 1973, the judiciary; Senator Higgins' bill, 1992, public safety; and then the one-time bill, 2190. So it's difficult to make the comparison. So what I've tried to do is just break it down and give you some basic numbers for people to understand. And we'll start with the Supreme Court. The governor recommended a $6.9 million increase for the Supreme Court over base. The House came in at 5.5, and the Senate at 3.2. So that's a fairly significant disagreement. Civil legal services, the governor did not recommend an increase. The House recommended $1 million. The Senate recommended $2.5 million. The Court of Appeals, the House and the Senate agreed with each other. We both created a new three-judge panel. We gave them $4.8 million for salaries and continuing judicial services. The governor was at 1.3. The trial courts, which of course is makes up the vast majority of our judiciary, the governor came in with a $38 million increase over base. House is at 41.9, and the Senate is at 43.4. So people aren't that far apart on trial courts or the appeals court. The one place we are far apart on is the Supreme Court. For the smaller agencies within this division, the tax court, uniform laws, and board of judicial standards, pretty much everybody agrees. And I'll go line by line if you want me to later, but I'm just giving an overview right now. Then we come to the public defender. The governor recommended $7.5 million for the public defender for the biennium. The House has appropriated in their bill $10.3 million, and the Senate has appropriated $19.5 million. So that is a major separation. So Supreme Court and the public defender are obviously we disagree on. Now there are other issues. The biggest one is, in like we said yesterday, on the compensation issue. The Senate took a position where they gave everybody, 3.25%, all state civil servants, 3.25% increase. The House is at the 2% for everyone except for DOC, where they are at 4.25%. Then in the Senate, there was an amendment that gave the 300 and some, 310 judges, a 5% increase. So that is, I think that's a major point of contention, because the House gives the judicial branch a 2% increase, and the Senate gives the judges 5% and everybody else 3.25%. And so that is something we're going to have to discuss. Then what we have, I'll actually go to the spreadsheet now. Normally, the governor and often the legislature just gives a one-line appropriation for these for the courts and the public defender. This year, we were very prescriptive, both the Senate and the House. For example, in the district courts, we have separate lines for the increase in funding, the salary compensation, and then very prescriptive lines for the mandated services, statutorily mandated services, which include psychological services, interpreters, informa pauperis, and guardian ad litem. And both the House and the Senate break those out individually. And that is new. Normally we've given them much more discretion. Then we have the new judge units. We have 6 for the House, 7 for the Senate, and I think passing out a map of the state of Minnesota and its 10 judicial districts. The governor's recommendation for new judgeships was 2 in the 1st district, 1 in the 3rd, 1 in the 7th, 2 in the 9th, and 3 in the 10th. Chairman Foley's recommendation is 1 in the 1st, 1 in the 3rd, 1 in the 7th, 2 in the 9th, and two in the 10th. The court has since told the legislature that they have that they've done a weighted caseload and that their priorities are a little different from the governor's, but that's another issue we're going to have to discuss because it looks like we are going to hire new judges and the legislature will have to decide with the court where they should be. But as it stands now, this is the Senate position. Then I'd like to move on to the Public Defense Board, which, as I said, was there was a major difference. The governor recommended $7.5 million for the Public Defense Board. The House came in at 10.3, and the Senate came in and the Senate came in at 19. So. But the difference is both the governor just gives a one straight line appropriation, the House gives a straight line appropriation. What the Senate did is broke out the Public Defense Board appropriation and was very prescriptive. You had your compensation adjustment, your salary adjustment, but then the Senate mandated that the public defender appellate operation expand. It gave it a line item for the public defender shortfall, for lack of a better word. District public defense caseload increase. Part-time public defender data entry and public defense corporations. So it's prescriptive about how they need to spend that money. The House has one line. The Senate does not. Typically, in the last 7 or 8 years, we've given the Public Defense Board, like the courts, a lot more discretion over how they spend their money. There's one, I don't know if this is the proper time to bring this up, but there's one line that we may want to speak about today, and it's listed under the Department of Corrections on the drug court's reentry bed savings.
What line is that?
That would be line 211, Mr. Chairman. And quite frankly, what we need to do is find out, whether that is actually bankable money. And so, I'd like to hear some testimony on that. And that is your bill, Mr. Chairman.
And what I'd like to do on some of these, the Board of Defense, what we're looking at is budget for 2006 to 2007 totaled $122 million, 590 full-time equivalent employees, 420 of those were attorney positions. So 92% of the public defender's budget is dealing with staffing. And it represents between 80 and 90% of individuals charged with serious crime, handles over 176,000 cases per year. The public defender's appellate division during the period 2004-2006 shows a 15% increase in cases with briefs filed, 28% in supervised release hearings, 24% in the end of confinement review committee, 80% increase in the end of confinement review committee, and many of those are major legislative efforts in the last few sessions where we really focus more on sex offenders. during that period of time between 2002 and 2006, the prison population went 27%, and looking at the public defender shortfall, there's a fair amount of pressure building up from problems in the last two budget cycles. We're looking at personnel costs, mandated pension costs increases. And then on the public defender, caseload increases, I'll give you those if you want. We do have some folks from the public defender or the office and so on. So questions on that issue with the public defense? Anyone wish to speak on that issue? Looking at the district public defender caseload increases, serious cases increased between 2004 and 2006, up 16% in the felonies, 11% in gross misdemeanors, probation violators 11%, CHIPS 10%. So there's a lot of heavy use of public defender staff and yes, allocating $1 million for a part-time public defender and data entry. When you're looking at that, we have 40,000 excess hours. And the Public Defense Corporation, we're looking at the White Earth, Leech Lake in Duluth and Minneapolis, who provide a large amount of service to minority communities. They provided service in 5,000 cases that would have gone to the public defender if they had not been available. State dollars provide leverage for a one-for-one basis. Before I move into the courts, I know we have some folks that want to speak to determining how we're going and selecting the judges. Ms. Dossell, did you want to please state your name for the record?
Chairman and members of the conference committee, my name is Sue Dossell. I am the state court administrator, and thank you very much for giving us the opportunity to speak today about the judgeship need. I wanted to first start out by thanking both the House and the Senate for recognizing the workload pressures that the judiciary is under and for authorizing a number of positions in each of these bills. And what I have coming to you is a little information about the fact that these are in different spots in those two bills, and I'd like to kind of just walk through that if I might. I'd like to start by providing just a very brief background about how it is that we determine the need for judgeships in the judicial branch. It's different for those members of the Senate Conference Committee who may not have been on our original funding division. Since 1980, so this is now 26 years, we have used something known as the Weighted Caseload Study to help us determine where judgeship should be located and how many we need. The Weighted Caseload is based on a comprehensive time and motion study of all judges in the state of Minnesota for a 9-week period to determine on average how much time it takes to dispose of 49 different kinds of case types. Then these times, disposition times, how much it takes, or waits, are then multiplied by the number of cases of these various types actually filed in each county then to determine the total number of judges that we need and in what locations. So that's how we do it. The policy of the judiciary is, when asking for new judgeships, to base this on the most recent full calendar year of filings. So moving to this middle chart here, I want to talk a little bit about that. When we put our budget request together over the summer and then submitted it in October to the Department of Finance, the last full year of filings was, of course, 2005. And so that is on the basis of which we asked for 9 new judgeships was the full 2005 filings using the weighted caseload analysis. And if you look on the column that says 2005 there, that is the number that we asked for and the order that we were going to ask for that in the budget documents, and also was what we presented to the Senate, because at that time we still only had 2005 data. And it takes quite a while at the end of the year to massage this data, to make sure it's cleaned up, to have the various district and county administrators assure its accuracy. So it normally we're in March before we are finalizing that data. So when we presented to the Senate, we said this is our most recent data. We expect to have updated data. But this is the ranking, and we'd like to, I think we believe we talked to staff about wanting to continue to work on this and perhaps update this as we went through the session. But you can see in the Senate bill, the Senate worked within the 9 ranking. This is a ranking according to the relative needs. So, for example, the district that needs judgeships the most in the 2005 is the 10th district. The second most needy district is the 1st, and the 3rd is the 10th, and so forth. So that's a relative ranking, beginning with the districts that need it the most down to those that are least in need of judgeships, but still need in need of judgeships. So the Senate used that the 9 judgeships we asked for, but allocated only 7 of the 9, and as you can see, skipped rankings 5 and 6, and moved, and then for that would be the 10th and the 1st district, respectively, and moved down to the 7th, 3rd, and 9th. That's in their bill. Now, by the time we got to the House and its decisional process, we had the 2006 filing data. And we came forward and gave the staff the new updated filing data, and based on what that new filing data, what the relative ranking is now with the updated information. And that's what's shown under the 2006 column. And as you can see next to that, the House bill tracks the recommendation that we made. The House recommended 6 judgeships and followed that ranking 1 through 6. So that's where we are now between the House and the Senate. Now, we had a glitch that we just discovered last week. That in looking at some of this data, I think it was Anoka County in particular, the court administrator there, it just didn't look right. The numbers, for some reason, looked low. And we went back, looked in the data, and we, as you know, we're moving from our old case management system, TSIS, to our new case management system, MNSIS. And some of that, we don't know exactly where the problem occurred. But we found in going back for the Anoka County, looking at every month for that county, that 3 random months, August, October, and November, minor criminal cases weren't counted for Anoka. So then we looked at all 87 counties, and we found that in the 7th district, 5 counties, and in the 9th district, 7 counties had 1 month where the minor criminal was not counted. We have yet to figure out what happened in the software that this did not occur. But we've restored those numbers now, And the revised ranking is the column on the extreme right there, the 2006 R. And what that did, by putting the more case filings for the 10th District and for specifically the 7th District, it had the effect of moving the 3rd District from the 6th judgeship to the 8th judgeship and moving the 10th District up to the 6th judgeship. So that's where we stand in terms of our recommendations to you. We have historically, for all of this time, used the weighted caseload as our indicator of objective need, and this is why we're bringing this information forward to you. If you look on the bottom part of this sheet, you'll see that as we indicated in 2005 at the year-end, we needed 9 new judgeships. Now, in doing the calculations of 2006, we see that the workload has grown substantially such that we now need double that number. So we need 18 judgeships right now. And just to give you some idea, this is coming from some increase in felonies, a significant increase in DWI. There's a big increase in misdemeanor DWIs and 11% just in this last year increase in gross misdemeanor. Implied consents, some in major civil and even some in probate. So my point, I think, to say is we need as many judgeships as the legislature would be willing to authorize. And we'd like to work with you in any way we can to see if that might be possible. But we certainly need as many judgeships as possible. We're asking for 9. And we'd like to work with you to see if that's possible.
Mr. Pamer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sell, I just want to be clear about what we're talking about with this weighted caseload sheet that you handed out. I'm not sure that I'm totally tracking it, but if I understand correctly, we look at the extreme right column. Would I be correct in stating that if the Senate 7 judgeships were accepted, or the House, or that on line 7, we'd sort of draw a line right there, and that would mean there would be, based on ranking, that there would be 3 judges for the 1st District, or am I reading that wrong?
That's correct.
And then 2 for the 10th?
Correct.
1 for the 9th, 1 for the 1st, and 1 for the 7th. And given at least the Senate 7 judgeships in their bill, the 3rd and the 5th would not get a judgeship under the current scenario in the Senate bill. And in the House bill, the 7th Judicial District would not get a judgeship. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And Mr. Salas, how you've been doing this weighted caseload measurement for how long?
Mr. Chair, since 1980, we've had it for 26 years, and we do a new time and motion study periodically every 5 years, but we use those weights then and are consistently applying them to the filings at the time.
And can you just say again how you discovered that there was a problem with your measurement? Is someone from the 4th?
Anoka, Mr. Chair.
Anoka.
Anoka County was looking at the data for its counties. So we usually are looking at the district level, and then we send it out to the counties for them to look at in their counties. Does this make sense? And this is how we kind of find issues. And Anoka County looked at a drop in their numbers, and from just their own sense, they just didn't feel like that was correct. So we went back, and we initially just went back for a few months, and we didn't find anything. And then when we went back in time, we found these random months. For some reason, the counter did not include the minor criminal. And then, as I say, we went back, and we looked at all 87 counties to see if this was a problem other places. And we found, as I said, that a few counties in the 7th and some counties in the 9th and Anoka County in the 10th had this problem. The other counties were only affected by 1 month, but nevertheless, those numbers were not in. So when we put those numbers in and then recalculated the formula in terms of the relative need, this column on the right is what our new recommendations are to you.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Sal, let me ask you this. Has this ever happened before when you were calculating caseloads, and do you think it's possible that it's had an impact on the judgeships?
Sorry, I have a hearing problem, and so I couldn't hear you. What did you say?
Mr. Sal, I'm trying to find out if this has happened before, where you found these errors after making recommendations to the legislature for new judgeships for judicial districts.
Mr. Chair and members, to my knowledge, we've never been in this position before where we've made a recommendation. We have had a change to update the data, as we've indicated. We indicated in the beginning that new data would be coming in, but this error, finding an error in some of the underlying case filings, this is the first time. And we certainly apologize. We feel terribly for the districts and for the committee, but we have, within the judiciary, have always relied on the weighted caseload as our measure, and it was wrong, and we have corrected it now, and this is the recommendation that we have made to you.
Mr. Silk, can you tell us how this how this weighted caseload was developed and who did it, and is it in use by any other state? Or
Mr. Chair, there are a number of other states that have the weighted caseload system. I believe Minnesota was among the first. I think California probably had one before 1980. But we adopted one early in 1980 and have been a leader in this for many, many years. Most recently, we have engaged the National Center for State Courts to work with our research and evaluation team and a very big group of judges and administrators as we developed the most recent weighted caseload, which I think was done in 2004.
Thank you.
It's a very comprehensive study, and Mr. Chair, and I would just indicate that it is sort of a
Representative Hillstrom, please.
All right, Ms. Dosell, has the legislature ever strayed from your recommendations previously?
Ms. Dosell,
Representative Hillstrom, to my knowledge, no. I think the legislature has consistently, over time, referred to the judiciary's recommendation based on the weighted caseload.
Are there any more questions of this witness?
I can wait.
Senator Neville.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. The change from 05 to 06, 9 new judgeships to 18 needed, seems pretty large. Can you get us more data to show what happened just between those 2 years to double the shortage?
I have information here that I'd be glad to provide to you where that, what kind of case types this is.
Okay.
Representative Lighting.
Labeling.
Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to ask that very same question, if you're going to provide us with that, which I would really like to see it, could you please break out for us? You mentioned that the increase was due to felonies, misdemeanor DUI, gross misdemeanor DUI, and implied consent cases. And could you break that out for us by judicial district so that we can see where those increases have occurred?
Just on the back of the sheet, we provided the map too, but also indicating where, according to this revised 2006, where these judgeships would go for the 9 judgeships. And I will just say, we're asking for 18 judgeships. I just wanted to use that to put in context the pressure that is happening in terms of the workload and how much the 9 are needed.
Senator Neville.
And this, just to follow up on that, What's happening in the first district, too, if you particular detail on that? And I live right next to it. I guess it must be happening in Dakota County, I suppose.
Surrounding your...
And Scott County, Dakota and Scott. That seems also like a very dramatic increase just in that one district.
Senator Rosen, did you have a question? Representative Paymark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Unless we're still talking about weighted caseload, I have another question of Mr. Sal about the salary increases. Actually, Mr. Carger, I was wondering if you could maybe, we talked about the 3.25 in the Senate and then 5% increase. The court recommended 5.24. What did you recommend for the judge's increase? We're just trying to find a dollar amount here so we can take it out of percentages.
Discuss the recommendation from the court mirrors the recommendation of the compensation council to be 5% in the first year, 5% in the second year, and a weighted average in the out years.
I'd like Mr. Carger to give us a dollar amount of what the differential between the House, the Senate, as well as what the court is recommending.
Mr. Chair, get some numbers here from the courts, and the amount I'm coming up with between their recommendation, and the Senate has their recommendation, the 5%, the House has the 2%. For the biennium, it would be $4.438 million.
Mr. Kager, what you're looking at, though, is just the judges and the salary that Mr. Turner can give you the data for the other folks, because there's some 2%, 3.2%, or 3.25%, and the 5% for the judges.
Yeah, correct. Mr. Chair, this would be simply for the judges, the difference between the 2% and the 5% number.
4.1.
It's $4.438 million for the biennium.
Any further questions? Ms. Norton, did you want to address the committee?
Members of the conference committee. My name is Sandy Naren, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota District Judges Association. And as Ms. Dussel told you, the request from the judiciary for this coming biennium was for two pay raises for judges equaling 5% per year.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, can you speak up some?
I'm sorry?
Could you speak louder, please?
Louder. Okay, I'm sorry. The request for pay raises for judges for this biennium was for 5% raises for the next 2 years. And let me just briefly explain the rationale for that. Historically, and I know there's a number of people on this conference committee who didn't serve on the budget division, may not have heard this before, but very briefly, judges are given pay raises only when the legislature expressly grants them. There is nothing in law that gives them cost of living increases, that gives them step or merit increases, like some of the unions have in their contracts. There's nothing automatic. The legislature has to grant them pay raises specifically. And historically, the pattern has been somewhat erratic. They're given raises for a number of years, and then they're given no raises at all for sometimes up to 4.5 years. That's what happened in the 1990s. There was no raises for judges at all from January of 1993 till July of 1997. They got zero during that time. And as a result, judges' ranking with other states fell quite significantly. By 2001, judges were about 35th in the country behind Mississippi and Alabama. And that was a place that we historically had not been before. The legislature was extremely generous for the several years following that, brought the judges back up to about 18th in the country, where we historically have always been previously. And in 2005, when we appeared before the legislature, the judiciary said, we're very happy where we are right now. We don't need any significant increases to play catch up any longer. And we asked for just a small incremental raise of about 3%, and I think that's what the Comp Council recommended in 2005, and said if you keep us on par with incremental increases like the rest of the full-time union employees get in the state, we'll be fine with that. The legislature in 2005 did not grant that 3% raise. They gave half of that. And so now judges in Minnesota have fallen from 18th in the country to 28th. I think when I testified in committees, we thought maybe they were 24th. They've now fallen four more slots. Since this issue was addressed in both of the budget committees, the Compensation Council that meets every 2 years and makes recommendations to the legislature on pay raises for legislators, judges, executive branch people, did issue their report, and I have just handed out a copy of that. And their report and their recommendation to the legislature is identical with what came out of the Senate bill. They recommended 5% pay raises for the next two years, and then they also recommended two pay raises for judges in the two out years, in 2009 and 2010, that would be tied in a formula to what the unions negotiate for their other state employees. That recommendation is in line with what the legislature has done several times before. In 1997 and in 2001, the pay bills passed for judges were for 4 years, and the out years were tied to union negotiated raises. So there is some history for having done it that way before.
Because
the legislature didn't grant the raise that we requested in 2005, we're trying to play a little bit of catch-up by going to 5% instead of asking for the 3%, which is what we would have normally have done. And then after that, we would be thrilled to tie it to what the unions negotiate. We have made that point a number of times over the years. I would be thrilled if that was tied permanently into law and I was put out of a job. And I think I testified to that in committee before. It would certainly be a lot easier. In a lot of other states, judges' raises are tied to a formula that is automatically in law that gives them regular increases tied to that.
Mr. Turner, I knew I'd come back sooner.
Mr. Chairman, members, everything Ms. Niren has said is correct. Judicial salaries are set by the legislature. They are not hitched to any state union negotiation. However, it is the Senate position this year that we would hike the judicial salaries by 5% and then also hitch judicial salaries to state union negotiations for the years 2009 and 2010. And that is a major difference between the Senate and the House.
Mr. Chair, one other chart that I handed out just now is a chart that was prepared by Greg Hubinger from the LCC. And this is a chart that shows what the unions have received in average pay raises for the last 22 years. He was kind enough to prepare this in prior years and updated it for us this year. And what that will show you is the across the board and the merit step increases that were given to the union members during that period of time. And I think the main point I want to make by showing you this chart is that when you make the decision to grant a certain percent for state employees' wages, that is not what, in fact, they end up getting. What they get is what their unions negotiate for them. And part of that negotiations takes into consideration steps and or merit increases. So, for instance, if you look at the chart for the last 2 years, AFSCME employees for each of those last 2 years received average increases of 4.75%, not the 2% that you thought you gave them. So that is the reason that I think an argument can be made for the disparity between the judicial pay raise in this bill and what you're giving other state employees. If, in fact, the state employees were only getting the 3.25%, that would be one matter, but they won't. They'll get what their unions negotiate for them, and in addition, they'll receive step and merit increases. If you look back at this history over 22 years, on average, all the union employees deservedly received 4.75 to 7 or 8% per year between the across-the-board and the merit step increases that were given to them. And in the court system, a very significant percent of those employees receive those step and merit increases in addition to the across the board. It's a very common misunderstanding. A lot of legislators think that when you give them 2% or 3.25, that that's all they get. But in fact, this chart shows you that that's not in fact what happens. The other points that I made in committee, very briefly, there's an article that I also just circulated. One of the things that we asked you to consider in deciding how to set judges' raises in any year is what's happening in the private and public sector. The article shows you what's now happening in the private sector. The article in the Minnesota Lawyer shows that the biggest firms in town are offering entry-level salaries to students out of law school that is almost identical to what district court judges with 30 years of experience on average are being paid. They're offering salaries of $120,000 for starting employees coming out of law school with no experience. That's one thing we asked you to consider. And that disparity is growing. We don't expect you to keep up with the private sector because there's no way you could do that. But it's something that you should consider because it is starting to affect the people who are applying for judgeships. The second factor that we asked you to consider more importantly is what's happening in the rest of the public sector. In 2005, the legislature significantly lifted the cap on governmental pay, and as a result of that, there are many, many local government employees, county attorneys and others, who are now being paid significantly more than judges are. You remove that cap, and that has affected those numbers quite significantly. I was surprised to see that. That was
Ms. Nairn, could you tell us, have you seen any people that have quit as judges because of the compensation problems?
Mr. Chair, there have been anecdotally a number of people who have left the bench because of it. I think more likely what happens is that people don't apply to begin with because of that disparity, because of the growing disparity.
Could you tell me where you've had difficulty in filling slots? It seems to me that when the thing goes out there's a fair amount of applicants, and I know personally a number of them, and I certainly wouldn't think there was any problem with the quality of the people that I know that are serving as a district judge. I think we've got some wonderful, well-qualified judges, and it's our intention to keep it that way, but we want to look at it in a fairness way. In addition to that, you've got a situation when you look at the thing with the public defenders and all of those others, you just aren't isolated by yourself, and you're not subject to layoff. There's a lot of advantages, I think, to think about that aren't directly related to that other folks don't get. And I certainly don't want to take that away, but on the other hand, I think this body has to look at that very carefully and see how we're doing it. I don't think that there is time to go in a direction where we're tied to any set salary ranges or things of that nature. It strikes me as that with the separation of powers and other things, the compensation package is about the only control that the legislature has in dealing with the judges. And I'm not saying that's good or bad, but I just want to bring that to your attention.
Mr. Chair, you won't get any argument from me that we have a very high-quality bench. I think we're very lucky in Minnesota to have the non-political, impartial, competent bench that we do. And I think they're very hard-working. The legislative auditor did an extensive audit of the court system about 6 years ago and said that judges in Minnesota handle 49% more cases than judges in comparable states. So I don't think we have any doubt about that. I just will tell you anecdotally that the makeup of the people who apply for the bench is changing slightly. You are getting more public sector appointments and a fewer private sector. But I will certainly tell you we get very high-quality applicants, and we have very high-quality judges, and you're not going to get any argument from me on that. That's why the request this time is for just a slightly higher increase than before. We're trying to make up for the comp council recs from 05, which said give 3% raises for the next number of years and keep them on par. And because 05, that wasn't possible, we're just trying to make up a couple of percent here. That's all.
Could you tell me, Ms. Nguyen, what years or legislative sessions that we acted on a pay raise for the judges and those years that we met and didn't activate some kind of a pay raise when someone else got paid?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, I didn't quite hear your question. During the years when they received no pay?
Yes, that's correct.
What's the question?
I'd like to know what years that you didn't get, or the judges didn't get pay raises when other state employees did get them.
As I mentioned earlier, the judges, for the last big cycle when judges did not receive any raise whatsoever was from 1993 to 1997. I think it was 4.5 years, January of 93 to 97, there was no raise whatsoever. And during that same period of time, if you look at the chart that I handed out, AFSCME employees received anywhere from 2.5% to almost 6% raises during those same years, and MAPE employees received a little bit more. So back in those, in the 1980s, there was also, I think, a 3 or 4 year gap. In the 70s, the same thing. And erratically giving raises to judges is, or to any employees, is not the best way to run a public system, because what happens is the pension people tell us it skews the pension plan. Judges or others retire at the time that the salary peaks without having paid their fair share all along incrementally. And they have testified over here a number of times that it's better to give regular incremental increases, which is what we've always advocated, than no raises for a while and then trying to play catch-up. And that's what the legislature has done, is play catch-up a number of times over those years. The other thing I would mention to you, Mr. Chair, is there are others, like the public defenders, whose salaries are tied to what district court judges are paid. So when you raise district court judges' pay, the chief public defender's salary cap also gets raised, and that, which raise, you know, acts as a ceiling for everybody below the chief public defender. There are others whose salaries are also tied to judges, administrative law judges and some others, all governed by statute.
Are there any further questions of either of these two witnesses?
Chair?
Yes.
Liebling.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Ms. Nguyen, that kind of brings a question for me. The last thing that you said about the judge's salaries being tied to other salaries, and so my question to you is, if we were to go to, say, 5%, are the other increases reflected anywhere in the budget that we have in front of us? I mean, how does this all play out? Or when do we see that other, those effects? When and where?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lievely, I know that the public defenders are impacted, but I think it has to be granted by their board. I don't think they're automatically tied. It just acts as a cap for theirs. Those who are actually statutorily tied to judges, I don't think are in this finance division, administrative law judges and some others, whose salaries are tied by statute to an actual percent of judges, are not in the, they're in the state government finance division. So I don't know how they've accounted for that possibility in the state government finance conference committee. Maybe the fiscal staff have a better answer. As far as the public defenders go, I don't think they automatically get the raise. I think it simply acts as a cap. They can raise the state public defender, and then they can raise other employees. And, of course, they have a substantial amount of new money in this bill, too. And I presume some of it may go for pay. I don't know.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sharon, this is very interesting, the breakout. And I don't think I certainly didn't know how this all worked.
Could you speak up a little bit, Senator?
Sharing. I was just saying that this is very interesting how this is all how this all works. And my question to you is the compensation, is that based off of years of service? And how does that work with, is there, I shouldn't say a disparity, but is there a difference between the greater Minnesota judges versus the metro judges? Are they all based off the same level?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, all judges of one court level are paid the same. So all district court judges, no matter where they serve, are paid the exact same salary. All Court of Appeals judges and all Supreme Court justices are all paid the same. The only disparity is for the chief judge of each judicial district and for the chief judge of the Court of Appeals and the chief justice. They have a, I think, a slight 5% increase, maybe 10% of the chief justice, above the rest of them for the administrative duties of running the court system. But otherwise, all district court judges throughout the state, no matter which district they're in, have the exact same salary.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Rose.
Senator, and it doesn't matter how many years they have served either? They all get paid the same?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, that is correct. The assumption is that this is a lateral move for most people. The average judge, when they come on the bench, has almost 20 years of experience in private practice before they accept appointments. That's the average. Some have been in private practice longer, some slightly less. But the idea is that you're hiring qualified, experienced lawyers to do a job. And so they do not make a discrepancy between a first-year judge versus a 10-year judge.
Interested
as a lateral move.
Thank you.
Further questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
The disparity between
before we get too far, while we still have Ms. Dosell and Ms. Nieren around, I want to go in the direction of the specialty courts, and I realize that it may or may not be your matter of concern, but we need to look at the drug court and the mental health court and other specialty courts that we're in. Mr. Turner, when you laid out the spreadsheet, you indicated a concern, and I'd like to know what direction are we going with the cost of delivery of services to folks in those specialty courts, and whether there is in fact a salary or a savings of money for that particular activity. I know that we funded some more specialty courts in our budget, but you're saying that the money isn't there. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, members, not quite. What we do have is both the Senate and the House maintain existing problem-solving courts. The Senate has a little bit of money for creating new ones. What my question was of the House position is how they came up with the budgetary savings, the bankable budgetary savings from the specialty courts. I don't really know how that works, and I don't know if the Department of Finance would go along with it, to be quite frank. And if they would like to speak to that, that would be, if the Department of Finance would like to speak to that, that would be great.
Is there anyone here wants to speak on this issue? Please tell us who you are.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Jim King. I'm from the Department of Finance. Mr. Turner's talked, or has asked some questions about the debt savings, and I can attempt to explain the Department of Finance perspective on that, but it might be, suggest it might need to have a chance to have Carter explain that, because I think he's been involved. Put the numbers on that, and then I could perhaps react to that. Or I could give you a reaction now, whichever you prefer, Mr. Turner.
Did you want to respond to that, Mr. Carter?
Right. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think I responded to some of this yesterday, and I think what happened here is that the chair and members of the committee and Representative Paymark, and correct me if I'm wrong, felt that if the House is putting in over $12 million for drug courts, problem-solving courts, the existing problem-solving courts, and reentry, that there should be some bed savings. Now, the House is, Representative Paymar told me that you could hide, I mean, we could have hit it and just, you know, reduce the base of corrections and, you know, carry forward or carry that into the tails. But Representative Paymar and members of the committee decided to be upfront on this and put in at least a placeholder to decide or let the conference committee members debate on how much savings, if any, there could be because of this. We do have information, and perhaps the courts could talk about this, about some of the estimates that they're coming up with from other states. We have a memo here that we can pass out. And, for example, they're talking about some of their recidivism rates. We have the number of, just one example, they have some information on their drug courts right now, where the recidivism rates are coming in at 26%, 14%, 33%. We have national statistics out there that that are showing that the rearrest rate, this is the rearrest rate, and I think, you know, some of the experts say the rearrest rate is the best way to look at recidivism, that it is about 66%. And this is from the National Institute of, or is the Bureau of Justice Statistics, and also our legislative auditor's report. They're looking at the rearrest rate both in from these people that are coming out of Minnesota prisons that are being rearrested either in Minnesota or in other states. Now, some of the outcomes that the courts are showing us are, you know, for a Ramsey County adult court, 26% rearrest rate, where, once again, the national statistics are showing 66%. We have the Duluth adult court, 14%. Now, I don't know over what time period this is. And I think that's going to be another recommendation that we have in there, that perhaps the sentencing guidelines, along with the courts, actually convene a working group and maybe even come back to the House with a report to determine how this is doing and, you know, what type of recidivism rate reductions that we can anticipate. So I would, you know, those are some of the ideas. And like I said, we may want to have the courts, I don't know if they're able to do that today, but to address some of the information that they came up with and presented to the House.
Mr. Chair, and to that point, I would add, and I remember distinctly in our discussions with the courts about the increase in drug courts, which our committee obviously supported. The fact of the matter is that these drug courts would be primarily created in greater Minnesota. Ramsey, Hennepin County already have their drug courts, and if you look at the statistics in greater Minnesota, drug offenders, particularly meth users, are going to prison for much longer periods of time in greater Minnesota than they are in the metropolitan area. So I think if you extrapolate those numbers, you would have to come up with the bed savings. If there was a way to divert some of these offenders from drug courts into treatment and not necessarily going into being incarcerated for long periods of time. If we don't have a bed impact, if we don't have a bed savings, then, you know, why are we funding these drug courts? Why are we funding reentry? I mean, it makes absolutely no sense to me. I mean, we have to base this on the research. I think Mr. Carter has given you some significant numbers.
Thank you, Mr. Premier. I represent Premier. I want you to know that my position is favorable toward the specialty courts, and that when you look at that, and if you only turn around one person, well, you've done a significant amount and per diem costs in the state prison system are certainly in the $50,000 range or greater, and there's a lot of money that's saved in that regard. But on the other hand, we really don't know, I don't think, that what are the real costs establishing this. We know that considering the staffing of those, and you have the judge, the court reporter, and the prosecutor, and the defense counsel, and all of these people, there's an awful lot of social workers and others that cost to the program. And I agree with your thoughts on developing some type of a evaluation program, a task force, workforce, work group, or something else. But we just want to make sure of in the Senate side that we don't get into something that is not reflecting the true cost. Mr. King, did you want to follow up on that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I'll make a couple brief points. As some members may know, there's just a few areas in the state budget where we actually project caseload as we go out into the future years, and the corrections bed space impact is one of those. The other primary areas are education and some human services programs. There's other, obviously, other agencies that have caseload issues, but this is the only, basically the only program that I'm aware of in this area that we actually do a projection. We have a fairly standardized process for doing that. It's a model that's worked through sentencing guidelines and the Department of Corrections. They take account of current sentencing information, information about when prisoners are expected to be released from correctional facility, and that's projected out. And as we get basically sentencing bills to the legislative process, you also see projections of bed impact on those. Now, I've talked with corrections and sentencing guidelines, and at this time, the factor of having drug courts per se or reentry programs, that is not a specific factor that's included in that forecast. If it has been somehow picked up in experience already, that may be in there, but there's no separate factor in the bed space forecast at this time for these items. So we have some concern about including that. Our particular concern is showing additional savings in the fiscal year 10 and 11 biennium. We recognize the legislature has the authority certainly to appropriate funds for the fiscal years 8 and 9. We have concerns about showing any additional bed savings in the out years for something that we don't pick up through any of our other models that we use for projecting bed space or corrections.
Senator Higgins.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. King, the amount that's in the House savings for these items, that number didn't come from you guys?
No, it did not.
So then may I ask a question of Mr. Carter, please?
Mr. Carter.
In the other states that you talked about who are looking at these things, did they book a bed savings and a financial savings in their budgets when they were working on it?
You don't care? Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins.
We didn't go into that detail. We didn't really question the states on that issue, if they booked a savings. Like I said, this was a subject that I think the chair and the committee members felt that needed some discussion. You know, you're spending $12 million. Is there going to be a bed savings? And I think there was also the talk, there was a Mr. or Representative Paymar has a study that is in the sentencing or in the rider language in the House bill, and it's calls for the Sentencing Guidelines Commission to look at the effectiveness of reentry programs in drug courts, and they are to study this and come up with a report to the legislature on it. So these are, I guess, you know, they're not exact numbers, but they're some numbers that we thought were probably feasible, to, at least for the conference committee to look at.
Mr. Kager, I've been showing what is on line 15 in the side-by-side, where it indicates the drug court fees.
Chair.
Okay. Page 24, line 15, authorizes drug courts to charge defendants fees for participation, provides that fees are credited to a special account and appropriated for the courts for drug court purposes.
Mr. Chair, I may, this is the bill that was drafted by, was authored by Representative Olin, I believe, and the amount is fairly insignificant for a court that would actually get the defendant fees as high. I think the maximum Representative Olin thought was maybe $3,000, and it's relatively insignificant. Mr. Carter?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Paymar. It simply allows the courts that are the state-run courts, my understanding is, to allow them to charge the drug court fees. And this varies. I think it's, as Representative Paymar said, it's only going to collect $3,000 the first year and then goes up to, I think, $6,000. And some of the courts are doing it right now, and it's a sliding fee scale. I mean, there's incentives. I think Janet Marshall was telling me that some will charge like a couple $100s, but if they go through each phase, it will be reduced some of the monthly charge. And this simply allows the new and the state-run courts to do the fee and then collect them. Very small amount, though.
Any members? Representative Smith?
Well, Mr. Chairman, if it strikes me that if the drug courts and reentry programs that the House is suggesting, fiscal staff is suggesting there's no savings, then that would raise a question whether we should do it. We have listened to House fiscal analysts justify and speak to at least and justify the bed savings, and since Senate fiscal staff has raised the question, has brought into question the House thinking behind it, I guess I'd like to hear from the Senate fiscal staff as to why they don't find any savings in these programs.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, members, a little louder. Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith and members, I guess in some respects I just... there is nobody that I hold in higher esteem than Gary Carger. But in this case, I just think this is a truth in budgeting factor or matter. I do not think that we can bank this money. That isn't the way the state works. And it's not the way the Department of Finance is going to allow us to do it. Of course these are good programs. But as a fiscal analyst, I don't think we can do this. Now, I would agree that if you just want to cut corrections, just cut them. But don't say you're saving money through drug courts, because the one thing we know is that there are enough kids out there every Saturday night getting in enough trouble
We've got the same amount of cops. We've got you know, legal calendars, as you know. And it's not like we can bank this money. And I don't mean to be a niggling little accountant, but it isn't the way, the proper way to keep books. And that's my only point. It's not that they're bad programs. It's not that, that was my only point. And you know, Representative Smith, I've worked with you and I respect you very much. That's what I think.
And Mr. Chair, to that point, this was not my idea either. I mean, this was the committee's recommendations, and I'm simply here trying to, you know, add some research to what the committee decided. So,
well, I appreciate your input. I share with a number of others here the support for those courts, but on the other hand, I want to make sure that if we are not making money or something, if we're losing money, that it be reflected in any of our documents.
You know, Mr. Chair, to that point, again, this is something that is, it's an area that I think we're starting to see. I mean, for this, for example, this is one of the first times that we do not have really a huge bed impact. In fact, we are showing bed savings. I think other states that we have researched now are starting to, some of them at least, are going down that road of reducing their beds. And I guess, you know, this is just maybe one other method, and maybe, you know, they do the forecast, as Mr. King said, that maybe with some of this extra money that's going into funding like drug courts and reentry, which reentry has, you know, we talked to some of the people from the network, and they assured us, too, that they were going to be looking at least a 20% reduction recidivism, that maybe it's something that, you know, the committee, the legislature has to take a look at.
Senator Olds?
Well, Mr. Chair, I was just going to add that we had the opportunity to visit a drug court in St. Paul through the Judiciary Policy Committee, and I wasn't part of your budget discussions, but I know that in my district we've just implemented a new drug court in Cass County. We're going to be hoping to do or replicating that effort in Beltrami County, and there are other counties as well that feel that there's a benefit beyond just the fiscal benefit, the savings, the bed savings, but the higher likelihood that we'll be returning criminals to becoming productive members of society and the effectiveness that they have in treating drug problems. So I think that should be weighed as well.
Representative Pimar.
Mr. Chair, if you will, I would like to have Ms. DeSalle respond to this discussion that we're having, since part of our thinking, at least on the drug courts, came from yours and others' testimony before our committee. You were asked numerous questions about the possible drug savings, or the court savings, as well as bed savings, if we were to agree to your recommendation for the 10 additional drug courts. So could you basically tell us what you told the House Committee about the savings?
Mr. Chair and Representative Paymar and members of the committee, as you know, when we testified, we were talking about the promise of drug courts and the learning that we have had from many others around the country. Drug courts began in 1989 in Miami. Dade County was the first, and now there's something like 1,900. And Minnesota is very much behind the curve in this. We have only one court that is more than 5 years old, and that is Hennepin County. And I think, as some of you may know or read in the paper, that the nature of that drug court is being restructured. So the data from that really is not relevant to today. And most of the drug courts that we have created are within the last several years, some of them funded by legislative appropriation last year and through federal grant monies. Because of that, in order to determine the success of these drug courts, it takes some lead time. Most of these drug offenders who are in the drug courts require at least 12 months to graduate, and many of them 18 months. And the person who testified, Barbara Klein from Stearns County, it was 3 years before she graduated from drug court. And then you need a period of time after that to determine recidivism, you know, 12 months, 24 months, and so forth. So that's why we're in a tough position to try and tell you, based on what we have done in Minnesota, what are the results, because our drug courts are not old enough to have produced those results. So the best thing we can do is to bring to you what we know in other states and around the country. As I said, we are behind the curve in Minnesota in terms of these drug courts. So there's a lot of learning that's gone on about what works in drug courts and what doesn't. So in some ways, to be a little bit behind the curve has been good, because now we know, you know, how best to structure these and what their components should be, and who are the best candidates for drug courts. So this is good. But in terms of being able to evaluate and provide you with data on what is the savings in bed impact, we can't do that based on Minnesota data. We just all we can do is to provide you with what has going on in the rest of the country, much of which Mr. Karger has reiterated to you, and I think is the basis on which you developed the savings that you have included in the bill. So what I'm just saying is that we can't give you empirical data on our success, because we don't have enough drug courts that are old enough, or any drug courts that are really old enough to provide that. What we have said is that a key component to our drug courts is going to be an evaluation of them, and that we are committed. We have formed under our judicial council something known as the Drug Court Initiative Advisory Committee. It's a 20-plus member committee of people from all of the stakeholders, including the counties. It's co-chaired by a judge and by a county commissioner. And this group is going to provide oversight to the drug court initiative around the state. And what we hope, in partnership with the legislature, is to move forward and bring these promising, very promising approaches to more than just the scattered drug courts that there are now, right now, today. And in doing so, to have an oversight group that is going to manage this growth and will be involved in evaluating it. So I think that's the best that I can give you today, is to tell you that we believe strongly. We wouldn't be in this if we didn't believe that this is going to be successful. And we had, before adopting the drug court initiative and bringing that to you this session, the Supreme Court had a task force on chemical dependency, 18 months worth, and they studied the whole topic of this, brought national speakers in from all over to give them the very best knowledge on both the science as well as the operations of drug courts on the ground in other places. And based on that, that task force said to our state that we should have a broad and fundamental shift in how we're dealing with AOD offenders. And that's what we're presenting to you here. I can't give you Minnesota data on this, but we wouldn't be in this if we didn't think that it would have savings, and we think it will be both at the state level in terms of Department of Corrections and bed impact potentially, but also at the county level in terms of jail space and rearrest costs, probation costs, and the like. And there's an investment up front in this for what we hope to be and expect to have some payoffs in the end.
I think that's clear that there's a big investment needed, though, in order to make this successful, if you can do it at all. It's one of those things that that while nationally we've looked at a number of, in many states, doing much more than what we're doing, we still haven't proven, at least in my mind, that we're saving money at it. We may be saving the individual and making him a better person, but sure where you go. Representative Pittman.
I just wanted to draw your attention to a memo that Ms. DeSalle provided to the House Public Safety Committee, where she references the Ramsey County Adult Drug Court, and I won't bore you with all of it, but it talks about the 156 total participants from 2002 to 2007, the successful completions, the participants who remained arrest-free, and then she puts on the final bullet that the program has saved at least $500,000 in jail bed costs. So obviously, you are able to find some numbers here on the county level. I'm just surprised that we can't come to some understanding here in this committee that we would have some institutional savings at the Department of Corrections with these additional drug courts. So Mr. King and Mr. Turner, perhaps I'm not an accountant. Perhaps there's another way of looking at this. But it seems to me that at some point we're going to, if we can have an assessment of bed increases for certain crimes, it seems to me that we should be able to analyze the bed declines based on some public policy initiatives that we're investing a lot of money in. If we can't, then we shouldn't make the investments.
Sarah Rosen, did you...
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chairman Paymar made reference to Greater Minnesota, and I'd like to just ask Ms. DeSalle, there are several multi-county tasks or drug courts that are coming online, and you're struggling with how to figure out the savings on that. And I do think it's a little too soon to realize savings, but what is truly there, and I've been following a multi-county drug court down in my area, which is actually three counties have come together. The collaboration of all those counties and everybody together is truly amazing, and it would be hard to measure the savings, but it's what they've accomplished and what they can accomplish is what's very interesting to me. So they know they can't have their individual drug court in each county, so they've put aside their issues and they've come together and they're making it work.
Representative Hilster.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to comment that it isn't unusual, actually, that we book these savings, and we actually did, and Mr. Carter can correct me if I'm wrong, but when we implemented challenge incarceration, actually Representative Neville, or Senator Neville, I believe that you were very involved in that, even though we didn't know what the impact was going to be, we did book bed savings there as well. Isn't that correct, Mr. Carter?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilstrom, I believe you're right, and Senator Neville, you had a bill, I believe, in 2005 that there was some savings involved, and I'm just sure if I can pull up the old spreadsheet here, and it looks like you booked a savings of $1.85 million for the biennium in the Senate recommendations in 05 for one of your bills with somewhat a little different, but somewhat similar.
Mr. Chair, that was a bad thing to do. I think that the estimate was over 100 prison bed savings, and it's way less than that, which points out the danger of doing it, I suppose. Now, maybe Corrections is just being very conservative and prudent in how they're administering the program right at the beginning, but I think only 50 people have been released to date program. But you're right, they did get a fiscal note, and we did estimate some savings.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Neville.
Might add, we're doing the same thing on the theft thresholds too. You know, we got a bad impact on that. But
haven't you figured out that if this is a item that's popular with the right person, why you get a different fiscal impact on someone that's That's a well said
situation. Well, I think when you make fiscal, this is my gut feeling, is when you make these fiscal projections based on savings of prison beds, you got to be very, very conservative. I'm not sure what we're booking. It's over $1 million on the theft thresholds, 50 beds or something like that. I agree with what Mr. Carter said before. We haven't had a criminal justice bill for a long time that is actually going downward on prison beds. We almost always expand and have prison bed impacts going up. But when you try to project going downward, just remember when you create an empty bed, it's probably going to be filled by somebody else. When they find out that those jail beds or prison beds are now all of a sudden available. So I'm not so sure that we're always going to be able to book them. I just encourage us to be very prudent in how we do that. Careful.
Did you want to testify?
He's an interpreter for me because I can't hear anything.
Just repeating what's been said.
Does anyone here want to ask any questions of Mr. Ocell before we move on?
Thank you.
We haven't touched anything with the public defenders. Is there anyone want to deal with that issue? Representative Lieberman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'd like to just follow up on my previous question and just ask our fiscal staff if they had an answer about what Ms. Nairn said about how the judicial salaries relate to other salaries and whether there are other fiscal impacts that will happen if we were to, say, set the judicial raise them 5%, if fiscal staff on either side have any want to comment on that?
Mr. Carter?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling. Yes, there is some impact to other agencies. In fact, I think and Mr. Turner can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the Board of Judicial Standards, the director there, his salary is tied to the judge's increase, along with the hearing examiners who are in the state government. So there would be some impact in the state, at least the state government area.
Mr. Carter?
Mr. Chairman, yes, theoretically there's, and members, theoretically there are a number of salaries that are attached to that salary ladder. My concern is, as an analyst looking at the courts, is that you've got a lot of court employees who are not judges. And we only give them so much money. And they can only, I mean, the legislature appropriates so much money, period. And so if it's spent on judicial salaries, it's not spent on other salaries. That's the essence of it. And please correct me if I'm wrong.
Representative Lieberman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, what about sort of the extension of the question, which is, are we accounting for any of those potential increases anywhere else, or how is it accounted for? Would it be in the next budget cycle, or... You know, do we need to, if we decide to raise judicial salaries, how do we account for that in the rest of our budget?
Okay. Mr. Chairman, members, basically, when I pointed out earlier, we give them great leeway when we budget the courts and the public defender, because they are... they're not the executive, they're not the legislature, they're, you know, the judicial branch. And they get to spend their money how they want. And so you'd have to ask the courts, you know, where are they going to scrimp and save, you know, how many, you know, what judge is not going to get a law clerk? And those are managerial decisions that probably the legislature has no business sticking our nose into. But I mean, in the end, we
We, meaning the state of Minnesota, the Minnesota legislature, funds, you know, fund these agencies, and that's my point. And I'm sorry if I was out of line.
Representative Lynn, did you?
No, that's fine. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Neal.
Mr. Chair, I'm backtracking a little bit, but there's a little connection. What are we charging for a judge unit now? When we calculate our six or seven new judges, is it about $400,000, $450,000 per year?
We have a judge unit.
Which yeah, that's what I mean. The judge unit.
Chris, did you?
Huh? Yeah, I care. Mr. Chair, and I think the courts may correct me if I'm wrong on this, but the trial courts, it looks like a judge unit is $477,000 the first year. And then it goes down, I believe, to $459,000 the second year because of one-time costs, like equipment, computers, I suppose. Now, Ms. Dosal may correct me if I'm wrong on that, but I...
At least the way that this is scheduled now for those judgeships to begin in January 1, the cost for a judgeship is $256,000 in the first year and $463,000 in the second year, or $719,000. And that's assuming that they would start in January 1 of the first year, so half a year of the first year.
Senator Neville.
So I didn't hear the testimony on the drug courts, although I did make the trip to Ramsey County. How much of that, what is it, $5 or $6 million that we're putting into drug courts? Is that all for other staff than judges, or is that's not for new judge units for the drug courts?
Mr. Chair and Senator Neville, that's correct. There's no new judge units in that number.
So, Mr. Chair, Ms. Cosell, I mean, if push really came to shove, what's more important to the judiciary, some new judge units or some new drug courts?
Mr. Chair and Senator Neville, the judiciary's priorities would be the judgeships before our strategic initiatives. The idea of that we need to take care of the core of our operations first before we start new things. And so that clearly is our higher priority of judgeships over.
And Mr. Chair and Ms. Dosal, I know that in this spreadsheet we're talking about savings to corrections for the drug courts, but are you maintaining that there's also savings to the court system itself by creating drug courts?
Mr. Chair, Senator Neville, certainly not in this biennium, or perhaps even in the next biennium. It's only with a downturn, I think, and the numbers coming through that we would realize a savings.
Well, it strikes me that, and again, I didn't hear all the testimony, but when the drug courts were created back when a lot of the courts were still county funded, I mean, a lot of the savings would probably be county jail beds as opposed to state prison beds. And so there was a little different dynamic in funding those drug courts. There was a reason for the to create them at the county level, because then there's fewer people in the county jails. Now they don't care. And it's a little more difficult to count on those savings at the state prison bed level when the benefit still is to the county jail. And so
are they paid part of the one-third that are less than 6 months that we threw back into county jail?
Now we're trying to deal with that a little bit by, you know, with the short-term offenders. But that still requires a state commitment before they get that, doesn't it? If they get the local county jail time as a condition of probation, we don't pay for that. So it seems that that's where the real savings of the drug court is. It's still pretty much at the county level.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Dosal, would you have the capability of doing a full ramp-up by January 1 of both the drug courts, if you were given the money for drug courts, as well as all of the judge units that you've asked for and that we have in this bill?
Would we be able to do a full ramp-up for the judges and the drug courts?
Yes, by January 1, would you be able to be at full complement, or how long do you anticipate the phase-in would take for these?
On the judgeships, we have just put in January 1 knowing that we need time to ramp up, and that's why we asked for it on January 1 based on our past experience, that it takes a while to ramp up. But, you know, we could phase those differently, and we have in other biennium where we've had judgeships phased in quarterly, for example, in other way than having them all start on January 1. So that would be a way within the existing funding to deal with the perhaps one or two of these additional judgeships.
Mr. Chair, follow-up.
Go ahead, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you. Ms. Dosell. So then how long does it usually take to ramp, you know, these up, both the drug courts to get one up and running as well as, you know, a new judge?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, the judgeship issue really is one in the governor's office that it usually takes about 60 to 90 days for the process. 90 days would be a good amount of time. So that's why we felt like with the number of judgeships allowing 6 months, that would be, you know, adequate time for the governor to do what the governor's office needs to do in publishing these things and going through the statutory process with the Judicial Merit Selection Commission. In terms of drug courts, there are many that are under planning right now, and that's why we feel that we can, you know, start these up and get moving with respect to the drug courts, because there are many in planning. But, you know, it can be ramped up later, you know, that as well.
Thank you.
Representative Lieberman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that really raises a question in my mind, because don't we, at least in theory, elect our judges in the state? And, you know, it sounds as though the plan is these are judges, they're all going to be appointed. So could you speak to that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, that is the Constitution, that when there's a vacancy in office, the governor appoints, and there is a vacancy as soon as these are authorized on the effective date, and so therefore they're our appointments. That's what they have been in my 25 years here, has always been new judgeships are a governor's appointment. And then they have to stand and run for election, as you know, within 1 year of their initial appointment.
Right. May I follow up?
Representative.
Yeah, I'm aware of how that process works. I'm just kind of, I'm new to this process. And, I mean, I suppose that, yeah, if there's a vacancy, but I'm just kind of curious, is this the way we've always done it, that we have the vacancy occur in such a way that it would be appointed rather than in such a way that it would, in fact, be an open seat that people would then run for?
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, I believe that's the constitutional interpretation, that once there is a vacancy, the governor, under the Constitution, has the authority and the obligation to appoint.
Mr. Chair, wouldn't that depend on the date that we determined the vacancy would occur? If we wanted to make certain it was an elected position, we'd just have to make certain that the vacancy would occur in conjunction with an election, I would think.
I think you're right, Counsel. Does you have an answer to what the position is? No. Apparently we don't have all these lawyers that we got here. Nobody wants to bite onto that. But I suspect that's right. We had Governor Cui head up a committee that looked at the question whether anything will come out of that is something, again. I think that in spite of what we've done, we've been able to manage to get good judges, and so the race to do something there isn't so... Honestly, I think it's more political than anything else, where you want to get somebody from your party elected, and the TFLers have been out of power for a long time, and so therefore there's not a lot of people on the various courts, whether that's good or bad.
I
Mr. Chair, could I just briefly respond to the comments made by staff? I do want to make it clear to the committee that the court's top priority this session and their request for new dollars was to take care of all the current employees in the system, including the judges. The judges' pay raise is not a higher priority than taking care of all the union members, which I think are number almost 2,500, 2,800 employees now. That was our top priority, was to fund that request. And so I do want to make it clear that judges will not receive any pay raises to the detriment of any employee. I do think the costs attributed to paying for the employees' pay raises, for the increased pension contributions, for the increased insurance costs, actually are higher than the raise asked for the judges. So we do intend to take care of the court employees as the top priority of the court system, not over the judges. So I do want to make that clear. And we do think that there's enough money being appropriated in both of your bills. You've both been very generous to the court system and new additional dollars into the system. We think, with that being our top priority, our number one priority over drug courts and everything else, that we can take care of everybody.
Representative Pavos.
Chair, a final question to Ms. DeSalle. I just want to make sure that I understood your testimony here today, that you said that there was not a savings to, in response to Senator Neville's question, that there was not a savings to the court with the new drug courts?
Mr. Chair, what I said is that there would not be, certainly in this biennium or the next, because we wouldn't be able to experience, I think, the recidivism reductions that drug courts, indicate until they have gone through, the folks have gone through the program, and that there has been a period of time to determine the recidivism rate. So I'm just saying that if we put on a number of new drug courts, then I think it would be difficult, certainly in the current biennium, because those people are just beginning to go through the program. And I'm not saying in the out years whether that's the case or not. I don't know.
Just for the committee, that's the way I understood your testimony, that the primary savings would be in the Department of Corrections. And again, the documents that you provided the House show that there is a savings to the court. So I just want to get that on the record, if indeed the information you provided to the House is accurate. Thank you.
Further questions? We do have the individuals from the Public Defender's Office. Does anyone have any questions of them, or do they want to speak to this group?
You're sitting there smiling.
Yeah. It can't be that good. Are we? Well, never mind. How about civil legal? You want to testify in the committee?
Good. Might have to defend it here.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Bruce Benneke. And I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Legal Services Coalition, the seven legal aid programs which together provide statewide services, both legal representation and community education to people in all 87 counties on critical civil matters. I will be brief, and thank both the House and Senate for your generosity and the long tradition of bipartisan support in the legislature for civil legal services. You have been very supportive. I'm hoping that I know you have many competing priorities and lots of important things, and I'm glad to answer any questions that you might have. Our request seeks to maintain the positions that we were able to gain back due to your support, generosity. In 2005, we were able to overcome the 25% loss in legal aid staff through a variety of cuts, and we were able to move the number of legal aid attorneys ahead. They had dropped from 178 to 134 statewide. We were able to bring it back up to 166. So we're still not quite there in terms of restoring everything, but we've made significant progress, and we're very, very grateful for your support of making that possible. I think we've spent the money wisely. I think that we're a very good investment. We hope that we can maintain that progress and not slip back again this session. And if possible, we would like to add a couple more attorney spots statewide if we could to address the very large unmet need for civil legal services that's been well documented. The court has been very supportive in helping us since 1982, as has the legislature. I think that legal aid, the first task of government, or one of the first tasks, is to ensure that their citizens have justice, and that's our job. So we are part of the court, essential part of the justice system, and making sure that persons of limited means have equal justice under law. And so we certainly, I think, are the right thing to do. I think legal aid is also the smart thing to do with all the work that we do in domestic abuse, combating homelessness, bringing in, you know, making sure that persons are in health care, Social Security. We save the taxpayers a lot of money in our work, and we also save the courts money by helping the courts to work more efficiently, and also by screening out a lot of cases from the courts that might otherwise clog the courts, and also through our preventative law screening and community education work. So I think that legal aid is also the smart thing to do. We are a good investment, and I'm very, very grateful for all of your support. And as you balance all of your important priorities, I think that legal aid not only benefits powerfully the individuals who suffer from critical legal problems, but I think that legal aid, by helping to ensure that reduce domestic abuse, prevent homelessness, and things like that, we're able to, in fact, benefit the broader community. So equal justice is our role, and I appreciate all of your help in the past to make it possible, and anything that you can do to grant us an increase so that we don't lose ground this session and maybe make a little bit more ground would be deeply appreciated, and the money would be well spent.
Thank you, Mr. Manicki. Members, have any questions? Senator Neville.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Benneke, the House increases your funding by $1 million, the Senate by $2.5 million.
That's correct.
You're at 166 lawyers now, so is it the House or the Senate bill that keeps you at 166?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Neville, by my calculations, if we were to receive $900,000 each year, we would be able to maintain all of the current positions that we have. And our cost per attorney unit is about $80,000, so 80 to 85. So each time you would give us an additional $85,000 above the $900,000, we would be able to add a new attorney into the system to help meet some of the civil, the unmet need.
So Mr. Chair, the House funding would require you to cut some lawyers then? How many would that cost you?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Neville, math was never my strength, but I believe that at a cost of about $80,000 to $85,000 per unit, we probably would lose about 5 or 6 attorney positions. Probably through attrition, we would go back down a little bit in terms of the number of lawyers available statewide to help persons.
Okay, thank you.
Are there questions? Members? Senator Hagan.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Benneke, can we talk in judge, or it wouldn't be judge units, in attorney units in legal aid? So when we're talking about adding a couple of attorneys for you, does the support staff get included in that amount?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Higgins, we try to be efficient. The answer is yes. Our starting salary in legal aid is about $38,500, and our benefits, we do have health benefits, but we don't have many benefits beyond that. And most of our lawyers, we usually have about, it varies a little bit, but usually one secretary for every 3 positions. So about a third of a secretary time, as well as operating, would be added into that $38,500 plus the health benefits. So that's how we roughly arrive at the $85,000.
Maybe you could get some judges to.
I just wanted to follow up on Senator Neville's question, because I'm trying to figure out how we, the legislature gave legal services, $10 million in the last biennium over your base funding, and I understand the cuts that were made in the past, and certainly didn't support that, but I don't understand how you would lose 5 to 6 positions if we were appropriating $1 million over the base. How do you lose positions?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Paybar, maybe I wasn't clear. At $900,000, we would not lose positions. And I say that for a couple of reasons. First of all, and each of the members of the coalition is a little different, but the program that I am the executive director of, at least for a little while longer, covers all of southern Minnesota, about 37% of the poverty population. And so, Representative Paymar, for instance, in our program, our health benefit costs go up 22% this year. And we also, when we added staff, we also add interpreter staff. We have to factor that sort of thing in. And so our calculations are that if we get less than $900,000 in terms of the cost of doing business increases we have because of, you know, of benefits, of rent, of all the normal things, interpreters, everything else that people have, that our estimate is that anything less than $900,000, we would have to start cutting positions again.
Mr. Chair, $900,000 a year?
Yes.
Side by side.
Senator Neville.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vinicky, I probably should know the answer to this, but you get other funding than the general fund, don't you?
We do.
Is that going up or down?
Good question, and I think this, Mr. Chairman, Senator Neville, goes in part to Representative Paymar's request. We've always considered legal aid to be kind of a three-legged stool. We leverage a lot of federal money. We leverage a lot of local money from the private bar, from businesses, from local government. So we've always been kind of a three-legged stool of the federal one leg, the kind of the local funding and pro bono time that we leverage the second leg, and then the state funding being the third leg. Part of our loss, and you know, again, the state has been very supportive and generous, part of our funding losses between 2001 and 2004 were from those other sources. For example, the federal money for Legal Services Corporation declined statewide by 16% during that period of time. That funding has remained stagnant till this year. We're going to get a 4.5% increase in federal funding coming next year from the Legal Services Corporation, so that is going forward. Some of our other federal sources, however, we get money from the Housing and Urban Development to combat homelessness and to do housing discrimination work and to do predatory lending work and mortgage foreclosure work. We statewide are going to take about a $150,000 cut in that. We get Department of Justice money to, you know, to combat domestic abuse and to do that kind of work. And some of the programs have lost some money there. We get federal money for senior citizens work, and that money has declined also. So the net, Senator Neville, when I added all together, is that statewide, and again, in legal aid each year, you never know, so you have to look anew each year, but my estimate is that in terms of these other sources of funding, primarily federal, that that by 2008, we probably, and this is a big probably, but we probably will be down $300,000 to $400,000, and combined, when you combine all these different sources together, we always scramble trying to find another funds. I mean, we always look for foundation funds and other kinds of things, and so, you know, in legal aid, I mean, we leave no rock unturned. I mean, the unmet need is so large, we always need to be hustling for money. But I think the net outlook, Senator Neville, is that 2007-2008, unless there was a change in priorities, that our federal funding that supports legal aid, other than the money from the Legal Services Corporation, the net will be a decline statewide of $300,000 to $400,000 of that kind of money.
Further questions by members?
Thank you, Mr. Benneke. Appreciate your time.
Thank you for your time, Mr.
I'm prepared to relinquish my gavel to you, I think.
Mr. Chair, why don't we take about a 10 or 15 minute break?
Ten minutes to the hour?
That'd be good.
Recess.
The Conference Committee Working Group on Judiciary Policy will come to order. I suppose we have, you've all done introductions for the full group. We have some new members, right? Mm-hmm. Our new members are not. Representative John Lesh and myself, and Senator Ingebrigtsen is there. But let's do a round of introductions.
Hi, I'm John Lesh of the House. It's good, Joe.
And you all know each other. Well, and we'll have Senator Ingebrigtsen introduce himself.
Chair, Representative Eastland is on his way, but we're trying to track him down. I don't think we really were starting at this time. So.
Okay. What we have thought about, and I've very briefly spoken with Representative Mullery about this, is in front of you and is an agenda. And what we thought it would be helpful to expedite the process a little bit, because as you look through the policy language sections, there's nothing in the Senate side. And so what we've done here is pulled together Senate bills that parallels language that's in the House bill. So while the Senate style is blank, we have bills, Senate bills, copied, and they will be handed out to you so that you can compare. As Senator Higgins says, small print with big print on the
size of the Senate bills.
My hope is that this will get us going. I know that there are other things happening tonight with the Tax Committee and the House meeting, so we might not get through. But what I would like to do is start, use this as a starting point, and as we take each section, I would like counsel to help us go through them and discern what the similarities are and what the differences are. Now, my goal is to make this as expeditious as possible. I think that we should have a discussion of it. This working group is by consensus. So by consensus, we could, you know, look at the language and decide if we, you know, want to recommend the Senate language or the House language to the full committee. And if somebody is not comfortable and they feel like, you know, maybe we're not ready to make a decision yet, we'll just park it and we'll come back to it. But I like to, at the end of the day, as we go through, if we have exact language, you know, then let's just recommend either the House language or the Senate language. And then where there's some differences, let's try to resolve that so that, you know, we at least are doing some work and getting some things resolved. What can we help you with, Representative Mullery?
We just were wondering where the Senate bills are coming, I suspect.
Some of them are being copied, and stacks of it. I think as we get to each article, they will be passed out, right? Because we didn't have time to collate all of them into packets. All right. And so, any questions?
So let's start with whatever article has its copy. Is that what we're
doing? Right. And the only article, Article 2, Section 1 is being copied, so let's go to Article 2, Section 2.
Do we have the Article 2 Senate bills?
Yes. They're passing now. We get perhaps counsel can walk us through since the Senate bill is being passed down, we have the House language. Can House counsel walk us through that? Please down here. Mr. Backus?
Madam Chair and members, House Research and I divided the bill essentially up. So Articles 2 and 3, I could explain them, but they can explain the other articles. Would you like me to start then? Both House House Article 1 and Section 1 and 2, I'm sorry, House Article 2, Sections 1 and 2 are part of the same Senate bill.
Senate 590,
so I'm not sure if that's been passed out, but I can speak to that if you'd like, or we can go to the next one, I guess.
Mr. Backus, then I think that's being copied, that's one of the, that bill is being copied, right? That bill is being copied. So let's move on to actually Roman numeral number 3, Article 2, Section 3.
Okay. Madam Chair, the next three House provisions, House Sections 3, 4, and 5, and maybe before I start very quickly, I could just point out in case, I think members already know this, but there is a reviser side-by-side document that's before you. You'll see a lot of it appears as blank space on the Senate side. However, some of these provisions have actually passed the Senate. They don't appear here because they pass the Senate after we finalize this document. So the next few provisions I'll talk about will be examples of that. And then there is a side-by-side summary that House Research and I put together with, again, the House language on the left and the Senate language on the right. And again, that might be even a little bit out of date, too, because the Senate took action on some of these bills yesterday and today. So then,
Mr. Backus, can you pause for a second? Mm-hmm. We'll have Senator Ingalbritson just joined us, and I'd like to have you introduce yourself. Maybe tell us which area you represent.
Okay, sure. Bill Ingalbritson, Senate District 11, West Central Minnesota, counties of Todd, Douglas, Grant, and Stevens County. For those of you that don't know me, I guess in my former life I was 34 years in law enforcement, last 16 as sheriff. So that's my background.
And then let's have the House members very quickly, maybe if you'd be willing to introduce yourself. So that's Senator Ingalbritson.
Senator Sean Lesh, 66A from St. Paul.
Michael Paymar, St. Paul.
And we have one more. House on East
Lens. Madam Chair, if people could leave their microphones pointing straight toward them, the wiring gets very fragile when we're moving back and forth,
and then the maintenance guys yell at us.
Mr. Backus?
Okay.
Can you make a page reference for us, just so that we're starting at the same point that you are?
Madam Chair, if we're going to talk about then House Article 2, Sections 3 to 5, that begins on page R2 of the side-by-side. And this language, again, appears as House-only language. They match up there, those two sections, with Senate File 1144, which is on the Senate calendar. And the first House section, Section 3, is identical to 1144, Section 2, and it makes a technical cross-reference to a new crime being created in House Section 5. So those provisions are identical. And actually, House Sections 4 and 5 are identical to Sections 3 and 4 of Senate File 1144 as well. What the House does and the Senate does is they restrict the current affirmative defense available to the statutory rape crime in third and fourth degree criminal sexual conduct, and they add a new crime in third and fourth degree criminal sexual conduct regarding if the offender performs massage or other body work for hire and the victim was one of the clients and then non-consensual sexual conduct or penetration occurred. So those three provisions are identical. Madam Chair, would you like me to go back to Sections 1 and 2 or continue to Article 3?
Let me see here.
I want to make sure that the members are looking at the Senate bill.
Yeah.
And they don't have the Senate bill. Do the members have the Senate bill?
Madam Chair, I'm just wondering if they're identical.
Yes.
We need to see the Senate bill. I mean,
not if they're identical.
Trust that he's
that
giving us
the
134 hasn't passed the Senate.
Say it again.
Senator Neville?
Madam Chair, what Mr. Backus just described hasn't technically been adopted by the Senate yet. It's on general orders, I guess.
Madam Chair and Senator Neville, I believe it's on the Senate calendar now.
It's on the calendar.
Pass off general orders.
Okay. Then it probably will pass.
Yeah. Okay. Ms. Backus, and all three sections are the exact language?
Mm-hmm. Yes, ma'am.
Exact. Okay.
We're good.
Representative Mullery, what
Should we sign it against?
Madam Chair, why don't I suggest that we adopt the House language for Article 2, Sections 3, 4, and 5? And because they're identical, so we'll adopt the House language for 3, 4, and 5, if I could suggest that. And if people object to that, they should maybe jump up and say so.
So is it a consensus among all of us that we will recommend Article 2, Sections 3, 4, and 5 to the committee? The House language.
Madam Chair.
Representative Fremont.
Just for the Senate's edification on the spreadsheet, this has a bed impact, which shows up on our bed impact line item, which does not on yours, just so.
Madam Chair, I think the reason for that is the section that would have created the bed impact was deleted in the Senate bill.
Say that again, please.
Chair Olson?
If I'm referencing the correct thing, Section 5 of the bill I was carrying that has this language, which provided for an increased penalty and generated a fiscal note, was deleted from the Senate bill in order for it to be heard by Judiciary after the deadline for the
Mr. Backus.
Madam Chair, members, I'm not 100% positive, but I'm pretty sure that the House bed impact language regards Section 6 of the Article 2 of the House bill. That's where you're amending the fifth-degree crim sex to have a broader felony penalty. And that provision is not part of Senator Olson's bill, and it wasn't part of this this motion.
Yes, you're correct.
That's
correct. Thank you.
So, hearing no objections, I think that by consensus we will recommend the House language for Article 2, Sections 3, 4, and 5. Mr. Backus, do you want to continue with Article 3?
Yes, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Article 3 then begins on, let's see here. It's page R4 of the side-by-side, and there are two identical provisions there regarding the phlebotomists and allowing them to draw blood in the DWI law. And those provisions are part of a number of other provisions that also relate to DWI law. Would you like me to go through all of them before you make any motions?
Madam Chair, Senator
Neville.
The yellow slip sheet.
I don't see it on R4.
Senator Higgins. Madam Chair, if you will all go to the yellow slip sheet. Each article has a yellow slip sheet. And so if you go to the one a few pages back, then Article 3 will start. And then when we go to Article 4, there will be another yellow sheet. And then Article 4 will be after that, and so on. And for some reason, they renumber starting with 1 on each article. You don't have slip sheets? They were... Michael?
Oh, right. I'm sorry.
Yep. That's these.
Got it? Okay. Everybody find it? Mm-hmm. And in your plastic widgety holder, there are some of these very nice tab things if you want to tab.
Mr. Backus?
Okay, then members, if you skip to page R7 of that same article, you'll see a number of House and Senate provisions. House Sections 10 to 14 and the corresponding Senate provisions amend and restructure the criminal vehicular operation law, basically make a bunch of technical changes and structural changes. There's one substantive difference, and that, if you look on the top of page R8, Senate lines 3.1 to 3.2 was a Senator Neville amendment, and what it would do is it would amend the criminal vehicular operation law to include situations where a driver had actual knowledge that a vehicle was defectively maintained and then the injury or death was caused by the defective maintenance. Besides that, sections 10 to 14 are identical.
This, I'm sorry, this is at the top of what page?
This is the top of page R8 on the right side, Senate lines 3.1 to 3.2. There's a new clause 8 there in the Senate that the House does not have.
Representative Lesh?
Thank you. Can I ask Senator Neville, I understand, you know, I carried this in the House, and I'm curious as to if this was not in the House, what was the reasons for that being added in at the end? Was that added in committee?
You know, I'm still trying to find it in the book. I'm lost here. R8?
At the top.
R9. On the Senate side.
Yeah, R8. Clause 8?
No.
Mm-mm.
Mm-hmm. Line 3.1.
Okay, I'm sorry. Thank you, Madam Chair. This, as I recall, this was primarily the phlebotomist bill, is it?
True.
That Senator Foley was the chief author of, and I offered an amendment in committee. This relates to a bill that I've introduced in past years, but didn't I just did it as an amendment this year. How much detail do you want me to explain?
Chair.
Representative Paymar. Mallory.
Senator Neville. I think we understand it was pretty, we discussed it, and it was in the bill as introduced, and it was defeated, it was taken out. So I think
I don't think it was in the bill as introduced.
Senator Neville?
In the House.
Yeah, Madam. House. Okay. I believe Representative Broad may have been trying to work on this issue.
It was Representative Lesh's bill.
Or was it? The main bill was, yes.
This was
my provision.
This was in his bill and it was taken out.
Yeah. I guess that's the reason I asked, is I don't recall that being taken out of our side.
No.
It doesn't show up on here, so.
Pretty thoroughly discussed and taken out.
And it was thoroughly discussed and was taken out?
Right.
Okay.
Yes.
Selective memories.
Very thoroughly taken out. So, Madam Chair, you don't want any further explanation?
No, we don't need.
Because I feel pretty strongly about this provision.
Oh,
and I'd be happy to give you some graphic examples of why it's necessary.
Madam Chair, could we ask the House why they thought it was not worthy of future consideration?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Higgins,
Representative Mallory?
People thought that this could be too easily used against people that don't have, that aren't wealthy and have their cars in perfect shape, and that also would discourage somebody from going, because if they went to a place to have it checked or something and didn't have it done, then that could be used against them later. So there was a pretty strong feeling.
It was,
Representative Lesh?
I think Senator Neville, it was, I'm not going to pay a lot for this muffler amendment that took out that provision. If you go to Midas and your brakes aren't adequate enough, and that was the concern, is that it was going to affect people like that, poor people, which I opposed at the time, but ultimately failed.
Senator Olson? Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just like to defend the reason for this to be included. We always consider driving to be a privilege, not a right in this state, because of the severe consequences that can happen, for example, if someone's driving under the influence. And if a car is not maintained appropriately, and when you have actual knowledge of that, you're potentially putting people in just as severe danger. For example, if you have your brakes are not working and you know it and you continue to drive the car. And there are people in the state who've been killed because of that. So I understand the concern about disparity because of people's financial abilities. But the fact is that if they can't afford to fix their brakes, then they're presenting a danger on the highway that shouldn't be allowed.
Madam Chair.
Representative Paymar.
I don't know if this is one of these that we want to put aside for later. Because I think it's fairly contentious, but we did have a lengthy discussion about it, and I think there was just I think a lot of us have had situations. This is the way I remember our discussion, that situations where you've gone into a body shop or a car shop and had a problem with your car, and you know it could cost $500, $1,000, $2,000. You say, okay, I'll get it fixed in 2 weeks when I get my paycheck or at the end of the month, which a lot of people do, and we've probably done. And you make an appointment for it, and then you're still driving the car. You may not know the level of the defect or the you know when it's going to actually fail, and all of a sudden you get into a car accident. And should you then be charged? You did know because the mechanic said that there was a defect, or you need to get this fixed, but you didn't. You know, you didn't get it fixed that week. Not just for financial reasons, there could be other reasons. So we thought that this was just a net that was going to ensnare too many, potentially too many people, although we certainly understood the intent of the original language was, we really did have a lot of discussion on it, and I think it overwhelmingly was the will of the committee to take it out.
We can come back to it.
Madam Chair,
Senator Neville.
Let me ask you this. If we could massage the language to deal with the situation where people might be, told by their mechanic, your brakes could fail in the future, and they decide not to fix the brakes right then, that make a difference? I mean, what I was really intending to cover in this language was a case where the defect actually existed, and they were aware of, and the case that generated this. Was a case of a person driving down the road with a trailer. He had been previously cited for driving it without a safety hitch. He continued to drive it anyway. The trailer came loose and killed two people. And the most that he could be charged with was a careless driving. I don't want the standard to be too low. If we can massage the language to get at the situation where they have actual knowledge that they're driving a vehicle that is presently dangerous to drive, would that make a difference?
Representative Mullery?
Madam Chair, Senator Neville, I think they could be charged under the gross negligence statute under that circumstance, which carries a severe felony.
Well, Madam Chair,
Senator Neville.
When that accident happened, I argued to the county attorney, why in the world didn't you bring it to a grand jury and try to do it? I mean, he didn't, and said and believed that he couldn't, and the person pled guilty to careless driving. And frankly, if a person's driving a car and he knows that the brakes are bad, and then the other thing that this says is that the injury or death have to be caused by that problem. Do you really want to say that people who know their brakes are failing, and then they hurt somebody because the brakes failed, that that shouldn't be something more serious than a careless driving?
Can I say,
Representative Lesch?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Neville, you know, one of the things I look at in this is the causation aspect, I think, is a pivotal deal. When you're looking at this in terms of a jury instruction, is the effect of this going to be what I think my colleagues in the House concerns are? You go in and you say, you know what, you should probably get a brake job because it's a minor problem. All of a sudden, the causation could be established that, you know, the brakes could have been a little bit better. Now, the condition you're talking about is when you're driving around in a death trap. It's very obvious that you're driving a dangerous vehicle. I think most people would agree that you can establish before a finder of fact that, yes, absolutely, the causation was there. So if there's a possibility of massaging that, saying a person had actual knowledge, not that if the brakes were slightly problematic, but that it was a danger to other people on the road, that may be why the language is a problem right now. I don't know. Is that what House members are thinking? If we could establish a more clear-cut causation standard in the language, it might solve the problem.
I think that we might want to set this aside, Senator Wilson. Do you want to?
Madam Chair, I was only just going to suggest some language that I'm not sure if this is what Senator Neville was thinking, but if we were to say where the driver had actual knowledge that the motor vehicle was defectively maintained in such a manner as to constitute an immediate threat of danger. If we inserted that language, I'm wondering if that would... Senator Olson, why don't we put that in writing and float it to the members? And this is by consensus, so we could do that. But let's come back to this. And Representative Lesch, will you and Senator Neville, along with Senator Olson, maybe take a look at that language and see if we can massage it to a point where it might be acceptable to the committee as a consensus?
Yes.
Representative Mallory, is that...
Madam Chair, I doubt that we're going to be ready for that today because there was a very strong...
It's not today. Okay. Not for today. Okay. For another day. For another day. For another day. Mr. Backus, can you just remind me, Article 3, Section 4 is the same bill?
Madam Chair, that's correct, and that's identical language as well.
But I suppose if we can't do Section 10, then we shouldn't do Section 4.
Madam Chair, they're actually different issues. The general common thread is DWI provisions, but that's a different issue from these other ones.
So... and maybe council can advise us. Can we make a recommendation on Article 3, Section 4 and just reserve Article 3, Section 10, and that wouldn't violate the integrity of the Senate bill?
Madam Chair, no, I think there's at least three or so separate issues in that bill.
Let's look at Article 3, Section 4. Can you take us back to that?
R2.
Madam Chair, it's on page R2 of House Article 3, and the language is identical. It simply adds the phlebotomist, I believe is how you pronounce it, to the list of people who could take blood samples in DWI laws. Mm-hmm. This was a provision brought to the Senate in the House by Professor Simon and his DWI group.
Representative Mallory, we should just recommend this. Representative Mallory recommends the House language on Article 4, Section 3.
Did you say Article 4?
I'm sorry, Article 3, Section 4. Okay. You're right, Article 3, Section 4. Now we'll move on to Article 3, Section 11.
Madam Chair, I kind of lumped all those provisions together. Okay. I think it was House Sections 10 through House Section 14, because they're all part of the restructuring of the Criminal Vehicle Operation Bill. Again, the only difference between any of those provisions is the one Senator Neville provision that you worked on. You could, I guess, you know, take all the language you agree on and leave the other issue to another day, or I don't know if you can try to do it separately.
Mr. Backus, that's all one bill.
In the Senate, yes, that's all one.
All one bill.
In the Senate, yes, that's all one bill, Madam Chair.
Let's come back to the whole bill. Okay. Thank you. That's helpful. Then the next section we're going to move on to, Mr. Backus.
Madam Chair, members, it's the bottom of page R9. It's basically House Sections 15 and 16, and they match up with Senate provisions that are identical. And these are provisions reacting to a recent Minnesota Supreme Court decision regarding the admissibility of certain lab reports and analyses. This was also brought to the legislature by Professor Simon's work group, and the provisions are identical.
And is this in the same bill, Mr. Backus?
Madam Chair, it's in the same bill. I believe all the Senate provisions that you're going to talk about today in Article 3 are in the same bill. They're all part of the Senator Foley bill, as was Section 4.
Well, let's talk about that, because what we've just done is we set aside the other articles because it was part of one bill, but
Madam Chair, how do you feel about that?
The phlebotomist piece was part of that same bill.
Right.
So I think they're different enough provisions that if we wanted to, we could take the other sections and hold off on the one that's contentious at this point.
Is that consensus? Do you want to do that? Because then we can go back and revisit the articles that we set aside as part of in the last, before we moved on to this section.
Madam Chair, I didn't hear what you were talking about there.
Because I thought we just made the decision that because it's all in one bill, we would move on. But if the consensus that we would address the different sections, even though it's out of one bill, then let's go back to the other sections previous to that, and then we'll come back to this.
Okay, Madam Chair, let's move sections 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, Mr. Backus, stop me if I err, 16, 17, the repealer is different. Mr. Backus, is all of that identical, though, all those sections? 11 through 17 of that same bill.
Senator Higgins, I know that we want to move on the same language, but I think there's an issue of restructuring of the different articles in the bills. If we, so we could take all of the House language with the exception of that
Section 10.
Neville amendment.
But that's actually a subdivision of a long list of things in Section 10, Madam Chair, so we probably should hold off on Section
10.
10. And then we can move 11 through 17.
Mr. Backus,
and there, I think they're all identical.
Are they all identical with the exception of Section 10?
Madam Chair, I believe they are all identical. The one thing that's of some concern is Section 10 is part of the bigger piece, which 11, 12, I mean, the restructuring kind of is one concept. So if you were to split the restructuring, I mean, at some point you'll have to adopt Section 10, either with or without the Neville piece, to come to full fruition of the restructuring.
Then let's hold all of it off. Because Section 10 was something that was pretty contentious, right? That's what we just talked about.
No, I just thought we could take the rest without that lines 3.1 and 3.3.
Let's hold it off. So that whole, all of Article 3 starting at Section 10 to Section 18 will hold off.
And then, Madam Chair,
Article 5.
We had Section, we had Article 2. House or Senate provision passed out. To Article 2.
And I can, before we move on, can I have a question for Mr. Backus or whoever else can answer it. There was an amendment, a provision added in by Representative Garofalo on the floor creating automatic gross misdemeanor up to a year in jail for any accidental death, motor vehicle death, and I don't see that in here. Would you be able to point that out to me?
Mr. Backus?
Madam Chair and Representative Lesh, the House language is on page R1 of Article 3, top left, careless driving resulting in death. In the Senate, I believe that provision was passed out of transportation to judiciary, but not at pertinent to jail.
But say that last part again, sir.
The Senate provision on this, I believe, was passed out of transportation to judiciary, but never heard in judiciary. So it's there's no comparable provision on the Senate side.
Okay, thanks. That's all I wanted to know. We can come back to it then, I guess.
Okay. Madam Chair, would you like me to pick up with Article 2, Sections 1 and 2 then?
Let's do that.
Okay.
Do all the members have Senate File 890? Mr. Backus.
Madam Chair, members, then I'll go back to the side-by-side Article 1, page R1, House Section 1. You can see it appears against blank language in the Senate, but Senate File 890 has subsequently passed the Senate. These provisions are similar. Both the House and Senate had a gross misdemeanor mandatory minimum jail sentence for violations of the repeat no contact order law. The House and Senate also both add a felony provision penalty for violations of the no contact order law. The House felony only applies to a person who, where the no contact order violation is the third, essentially within 10 years. The Senate picks that up, but has an additional felony provision, which is that if the person violates no contact order law with a dangerous weapon. And I believe that that was how the bill was introduced, so I'm suspecting that the House took that provision out in committee. And then there's one other difference that's more technical. It's on, if you look on House line 25.23, to reference to a statutory section, 518B.02. That's just a reference to the type of counseling or educational programs that one would be sentenced to. And the Senate doesn't have that actual pinpoint citation. But the main difference is the felony provision, the Senate having the dangerous weapon.
And what is the technical effect, Mr. Backus? Should we, generally, is there a place in the Senate bill or in the Senate language to insert that cross-reference? If we were to insert into the Senate language, would it make sense?
Madam Chair, yes, we could easily add that to the Senate language. I think this was another Senator Olson bill, and I believe the original language and the Senate language makes the no-contact order provisions basically identical to the similar provisions in the Order for Protection Law. And I believe that cross-reference was in the Order for Protection Law, so we probably should pick it up. And similarly, the felony provision, the Senate provision, is consistent with the no-contact order law, having the dangerous weapon.
Well, I think we should just recommend the cross-reference in the last section. And then we can talk about the more substantive difference. If Representative Mallory?
Yes, I think that we'd have to talk more about the Senate's additional language, but the cross-reference doesn't seem to be a real controversy.
Madam Chair?
Senator Higgins.
On the Senate bill, that's on line 2.2, after the word court, we would add the cross-reference. That's where it is in the House bill.
Well, let's, I think tentatively, we should take the two sections together. So let's have a discussion about the substantive, but with the caveat that however we resolve the first part, we will just recommend the House language on the cross-reference. On the second section. And then, Ms. Backus, the Senate language, the bill was not amended. It was just as introduced.
Madam Chair, it was amended, but that I don't believe that provision was amended. I'd have to look to see what the amendment was.
Madam Chair, I think
Senator Olson.
I think the only amendment was a real technical one. A paragraph was misnumbered or mislettered, and there was a change on that, and I think that was the only amendment.
I'll get to it in the next section. I just remembered what it was. So when you talk about the next section, I'll tell you. My understanding is Section 1 wasn't amended.
Members, is there do we want to have a discussion on the substantive difference with the felony?
Madam Chair, is there a bed impact?
Senator Higgins?
Did we get a fiscal note bed impact for these felony provisions?
Senator Olson, I seem to recall that there was a discussion about whether or not there was a bed impact. Mr. Turner?
There was. They reported a minimum impact, which means zero cost to six.
Representative Lesh?
Okay, I'm sorry, I missed that.
What?
I thought you had some input on the dangerous weapon.
Oh, no. Well,
should we resolve this, or is this something we should set aside?
I think we probably can resolve it, but there's some question about, we don't have a statutory definition of dangerous weapon at this point, do we?
We're just looking at it right now.
So I would kind of like to see that, but I think generally I'm supportive of that.
Of the Senate language?
Yeah.
Let's just find out what 60902 is.
Can I ask how that additional language made it into the Senate bill?
Madam Chair, I think this
Senator Olson?
I think this was the original language, and so the House must have taken out that reference, because what this bill did was to make a no-contact order be treated the same as a restraining order.
OFP.
An order for protection. So basically that was the language that was in that would apply to an order for protection, and it was just adopted as the same language for a no-contact order.
Madam Chair.
Representative Paymar.
The dangerous weapon provision is a firearm, loaded or unloaded. If you want me to read the whole thing, I will. But it's a firearm. But loaded or unloaded or any device designed as a weapon capable of producing death or great bodily harm, any combustible or flammable liquid or other device or instrumentality. So it's not a knife. It would be a handgun. Yes, we'll figure it
out. I think. Madam Chair.
Senator Neville?
I seem to think, recall that this would include knives, it would include baseball bats, cars. Dangerous weapon is broader than just...
Is that what the other instrumentality is?
Madam Chair, I've got...
Representative Paymar.
Got the provision here if you'd like to take a look.
So under this particular section...
60902 definitions... Dangerous weapon, subdivision 6. It's dangerous weapon means any firearm, whether loaded or unloaded, or any device designed as a weapon and capable of producing death or great bodily harm, any combustible or flammable liquid or other device or instrumentality that in the manner it is used or intended to be used is calculated or likely to produce death or great bodily harm, or any fire that is used to produce death or great bodily harm.
Knife would be in there.
Knife would definitely be in there. Pocket knife.
Members. I know we're in a relaxed mood, but we have it on tape. So let's be a little bit more orderly so that when people want to come back and hear this stimulating conversation and posterity, they will know who's speaking. Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think Senator Higgins brought up the bed impact, or someone brought up bed impact. But remember, I mean, these things, if there is a dangerous weapon involved, it's going to be charged as a felony anyway. And I do a lot of these violations of no contact order and violations of order for protection. And we don't see a lot of these weapon situations because they're charged out as second degree assault or some other level of assault. So I do not necessarily see there being a substantial bed impact. And it's an additional tool to close a loophole, I think. So I don't know. But that's my two cents on that. I think it's good language.
Counsel, is this the exact language that's in the no-contact order?
Madam Chair, it's the exact same language that's in the order for protection.
On the order for protection.
Yes.
Madam Chair?
Senator Higgins.
It sounds like we're coming to consensus on this is a good thing to put in. So I'll move the Senate language and including the cross-reference on line 2.2 of the Senate bill.
Is that a consensus? We'll recommend that.
Or I guess I won't move it. I'll suggest it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Does that take care of Senate File 890, Sebakis?
Madam Chair, there's one other provision. It's Senate Section 2 of that. Oh, actually, it's House Section 2 in Senate Section 2. So it's, if you flip to page R2, top left on the top side. Both the House and Senate amend this definition of qualified domestic violence-related offense in the exact same way substantively. The only difference is the Senate deleted some language that was somewhat redundant.
If you look on, it would be, I think it's House lines 26.23.4, where it says, includes a violation or attempt to violate the following offenses. The Senate believed that the following offenses would be redundant or not proper after you're going to violate, it would just be violate sections.
Right.
So it's just a technical difference, and the Senate thought it read better that way.
Okay.
You want to take the Senate language? So we will recommend Section 2 of the Senate bill, Senate File 890. That takes care of all of Senate File 890?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
And then any other extra provision that's not comparable to 890 that's in the House language, Mr. Backus?
Madam Chair, no. The only thing, you already addressed all the Article 3 provisions that match with the one Senate bill, Senate File 302. I assume when you mentioned, I don't know if you wanted to deal with that entire repealer, House Section 3, Article 3, Section 18.
The House repeals three things. It repeals a couple provisions in the criminal vehicle operation.
Where is it?
Article 3.
It's Article 3. So it's at the very end of Article 3. It's actually page R12 of Article 3. If you can see, there's actually two concepts that the House deals with. One is there's subdivisions 1 and 2 relating to auto insurance and verifying auto insurance. The Senate picks that up on a separate bill, and then the criminal vehicle operation provisions. So I guess you would want to skip the criminal vehicle operation provisions based on your early discussion, but I wasn't sure if you wanted to deal with the auto insurance provisions in this bill or do that separately.
Why don't you just take that language, Representative Mallory?
Madam Chair.
Representative Mallory?
I'm sorry, I don't understand exactly what we're doing.
Okay. Ms. Abakas, can you walk us through Section 18 of the House language?
Yes.
Which is the repealer on page R12.
The first to repeal is, again, it's exact same language. Both the House and Senate repeal two provisions relating to 2003 laws regarding how the Department of Public Safety could verify that motor vehicle owners have insurance. So the House and Senate concur there. My question was, is that something you wanted to do in this bill or do in a separate bill, like a transportation-related bill? Actually, it's more to use the manager.
Oh, that's nice. Ms. Abakas, the Senate language is from what? Which bill?
Senate language is from Senate File 1912, which is now considered House File 448 because the House file came over.
Oh. Senator Higgins?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. But didn't we just take this up on the floor, like, in the last couple of days? And if it was a House file, can't we just get rid of this whole, all this language?
Yes, I
Mr. Backus?
You could agree to let it go separately and be done in a different bill, yes.
But I think it's already, Madam Chair, I think it's already working its way through another bill. Is that what you're trying to tell us?
Right.
Okay.
But if you want, you can include in this bill as well. You don't have to, but...
And then, Mr. Backus, just to be clear, the criminal vehicular operations section on the House side has no Senate provision like it?
No, Madam
Chair. Mr. Backus.
Senator Higgins, it does. If you look over Senate Section 10, that's part of Senate File 302 that you were discussing earlier, the criminal vehicular operation changes. So given aside, you would likely want to put this issue aside. So my question really was solely related to the insurance issues.
Okay.
This is
should just not be in our bill.
This is a transportation type issue. And if it's already moving on its own, why don't we just leave it alone, Mr. Representative Mallory?
Sure, if the Senate if the Senate voted on the House file, the House must have already acted on it. Unless I misunderstood Mr. Backus. The Senate acted on the House file, so I think you acted on it, we've acted on it, and it needs to go away.
No, we're talking about
this.
We'll set it aside. Try and figure out
just to clarify, I looked at my notes, and that bill, has this been presented to the governor yesterday? So presumably it'll be signed separately.
Okay, so we can just cross these out.
Set aside permanently. We'll permanently set that aside.
18.
Mr. Backus, where does that take us to?
Madam Chair, that takes you to Article 5, Section 2, and at this point I'll turn it over to House Research and they can walk you through those provisions.
In Article 5, Section 2, what is the comparable Senate file so that we can...
1349. Sarah? Madam Chair, it's Senate
File
1349
from
the Senate.
Let's just pass that out first. Can you move the piece of paper so I can see your name?
It's Purius.
Purius.
You just knew that at the top of your head?
We're outside.
Nice.
Oh.
page on that.
Trying to get this.
Article 5.
Make some changes to this one.
Madam Chair, what page will we be at?
Ms. Perius will tell us shortly where she's going to start with the House language and the Senate file.
Sure. Madam Chair, if you look on your agenda, almost all of Article 5 is part of the Judicial Branch Bill, which was House File 1388. And then Senate File 1349 passed out of the Senate last night, I believe. And all of the language is identical, except that the House includes effective dates of July 1st. And the other provision is Section 49 is a repealer. And in the House, that includes two sections from the Judicial Branch Bill and one section from the Public Defender Bill, which we're not discussing, it looks like, according to this agenda.
So, Ms. Perius, we will be looking at Article 5, starting at page R1.
It would actually start on R2. And if you look at your agenda, it's Section 16, or Roman numerals 16 through 28, and Roman numeral 30. The only thing that's not in the Judicial Branch Bill in Article 5 that's on the agenda is Section 47.
Let's take Article 5, Section 2, 3, and 4. Because they're all together, and that's in Senate File 1349. Ms. Pierce, is that same or similar, same language?
All of that's identical language, except the effective date. There's effective dates in the House and not in the Senate.
After each section, Ms. Pierce?
Yes.
Is it the same?
Madam Chair, maybe I can explain this a little.
Could you please?
Again. If you look at the agenda, all of Article 5 except Section 47, mm-hmm. So it would be 2, 3, 4, 14, 16, 17, 19, 20, 21, 22, 31, 45, 46, and 49, those are all part of the Judicial Branch Bill. And that passed out of the Senate last night with identical language, except for the effective dates.
And the effective dates in the House file, Ms. Perius, has effective dates after each section? Is that?
Yes. Madam Chair, they all say July 1st, 2007.
And is that similar to the effective date for the Senate file for the entire bill?
There are no effective dates in the Senate file.
Oh, I can't believe Senator Betzel let us have a bill leave the committee without an effective date.
Just keeping it interesting.
Madam Chair, I believe July 1st is the default
anyway.
It's
the automatically default date. Well, we'll just incorporate, is it consensus? We'll just incorporate the why don't we just, let's discuss Section 47, which is the only section that's different in
yes. Madam Chair, one other exception is Section 49, that's the repealer. On the House side, there's one statute in there that relates to the Public Defender Bill and not the Judicial Branch Bill. So if you look at Section 49 on page R33, it would be line 96.11. The House side repeals section 611.20, subdivision 5, and that's not part of the Judicial Branch Bill. So we could delete that part, and then everything else would be identical.
What is that reference, Ms. Harris?
That's the fee.
Representative
Hamer? I'm sorry, Madam Chair. That's the legal fees.
Oh, the one that the court struck down,
right.
the copay?
I believe that's copay? Is that the copay. Is that the copay or is that a different fee?
Section 611.20.
Yes.
Madam Chair, Representative Paymore, that is the $40 per hour reimbursement rate for public defenders.
You have to speak to this slash.
Okay.
And that's yeah.
And, Madam Chair, I believe that is actually in Senate File 300 is identical language, but that hasn't passed the Senate. I believe it's in the Finance Committee.
I got it out of there this morning, okay. Madam Chair.
Does this have a fiscal impact? Is that why it's, Senate File 300 was in the Finance Committee? Senator Higgins?
Madam Chair, I think we took out... Oh, shoot, I just plain don't remember.
Mr. Backus?
Madam Chair, Senate File 300 was in the Finance Committee because there was a whole issue with the public defender copay and whether or not that created a hole in the general fund by striking it.
But not this section, Mr. Backus?
I don't believe that this, the repealer, was related to that. But again, the whole Senate File 300 is sprinkled. The House has a number of provisions relating to Senate File 300 in this article. And my understanding is you were going to maybe take them up some other time or something.
Okay. Senate members, I think it's, if that's the case, we're okay with this repealer. Yes?
I think so.
Senate members are okay with taking the House language on the repealer. The only other section is Section 47, Ms. Perius. Let's talk about that, because maybe we can just adopt, we can just recommend all of the House language, since the House language also has the effective date.
Okay. Madam Chair, Section 47 is on page R32. And as you can see, there is Senate language. It's nearly identical. The House, again, has an effective date of July 1st. The only other difference, if you look on line 95.28, in the House, the report is due on October 1st, 2007. If you go over to the Senate side on line, I believe it's 117, the report is due January 15th, 2008.
Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, this is my bill in the Senate, and in committee, I think it was Senator Betzold, in fact, who said that it was no sense in getting a report in October because nobody would be here. So we moved it to January 15th.
Overwhelmingly, the Judiciary Committee thought it was a great idea.
We'll take it then.
It's fine, but the senators obviously don't remember Wes Skoglund.
No, never served in a committee with him.
He was always around when he was at the House.
Then what we will do is we'll recommend House language for Article 5, Section, and Ms. Pierce, you can help me, 14? 2 through 4, 14, 16, 17, 19, 20, 21, 22, 31, 45, 46, and 49. And then we'll recommend Senate language on Section 47. Is that Representative Hillstrom?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do we need the effective date, which is part of Section 47, or not?
It's the same whether we have it in or not.
Oh. Madam Chair, it would default
Ms. Perius?
To July 1st.
I think if we're adopting all the House language, that would take into effect the effective date. Well, we'll take the House effective date for Section 47. Okay. That will keep it consistent. Ms. Perius? That will keep the language consistent.
Madam Chair?
Senator Neville?
I thought the default date was August 1st for policy-related things.
Right.
Is there a fiscal issue that makes the default date July 1st for this? Isn't the default date August 1st?
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Just, I mean, the only reason I ask is because you mentioned
Mr. Backus?
A couple of times now.
Madam Chair, I believe that, generally speaking, the default date is August 1st, but I believe it's in a budget bill, it would be July 1st.
Okay.
I see.
Just because it's in a budget bill. All right.
Anybody concerned about the effective date?
Madam Chair? I don't want to bring a big discussion up on this, but Senator Betzel did indeed say exactly what Senator Higgins did. But after we had our committee hearing, I was thinking about that. And
You know, you get these reports on January 15th, and you have no time to take any action on them. Is this the type of study that we expect, that there's going to be some some legislation drafted as a result of that report?
I doubt it.
Because if it is, the more I thought about it, it isn't such a bad idea to get the reports in October, because then you got a month or two to think about them and give Senate counsel or House counsel a chance to draft something. Otherwise, you're going on the fly pretty fast. You get it on January 15th, you'll look at it by January 30th, if you're lucky. So, I mean, I'm not necessarily so opposed to maybe compromise. Maybe we should make it November 1st. But then you got at least some time to read it before the session starts.
Representative Mullery.
Madam Chair, now I'm recalling this is my bill, and I know Hennepin County would definitely like some legislation next year, so I think, Senator Higgins, you might also want to have it before the 15th of January so that we have...
I'm certainly not married to it. I just don't want to explain it to Senator Bensfeld.
I'm sure I'll explain it to Senator
Bensfeld. All righty,
Senator Neville.
Okay, so are we changing it then to the House language?
Well, we've got two dates, October and November. I don't think that makes much of a difference. We can just go back and just recommend the House language. If that's the consensus.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry to bring up after we have reached another consensus. But
that's all right. So it will be all the House language.
Yep.
In Article 5. I don't know, Representative Mullery, you're beating us up pretty good here.
Wait a second.
Madam Chair, I'm going to develop some language on that other one I had that they'll be willing to take.
Article 6. That's Senate File 1336. And who's taking us through that?
That'd be me, Madam Chair.
Can you hang on a second and let's get this passed up?
Madam Chair, just
Representative Paymar.
Just wanted to remind the chair that we're going to have to adjourn, and at 6 o'clock, three of our members will have to leave.
I think that we let's see if we can get to the bottom, because I think if it goes as well as the other ones, we might be finished with today's agenda. But I will keep an eye to 6 o'clock, and we'll pause. We'll stop where we need you to go, Mr. Diebold.
Madam Chair and members, the first item in Article 6 is two provisions that are related, and they're Sections 10 and 11 on the House side, which would you can find when you need to obviously flip through the articles to get to Article 6, but it'll be on R7 of the corrections article. And there's a Senate File 1336 is the corollary to these provisions, and they are similar, but the Senate seems to have streamlined the existing language more so than the House. And give you kind of a general, these two initiatives are contained in one policy bill from the Department of Corrections, and they're intended to give them more freedom in transferring inmates with mental health and making commitment recommendations for inmates with mental health issues by broadening the group of individuals that are authorized to make these recommendations. And it's really I'd have to defer to Senate counsel or a senator as to why the changes were made. But it looks like the Senate version leaves it even, they use the common term licensed mental health professional, and the House accepted the bill as it came from the Department of Corrections without amendment. and the, as you can see in both sections, on 1336, it's a slight difference, and I'm not sure if it's a difference with any meaning, but it looks like
Senator Higgins, Madam Chair, the House language talks about the licensed mental health care professional or the licensed mental health professional. And I'll be darned, after sitting on the Health Committee for 6 years, if I could tell you the difference between those two. And I sort of suspect there isn't a difference between those two. So the Senate language goes with the phrase licensed mental health professional throughout. And I think that's all there is.
Representative Mullery?
The House, I think, will take the Senate provision on this.
We'll recommend the Senate language that's contained in Senate File 1336.
Yeah.
Mr. Diebold.
Madam Chair and members, moving on to the next agenda item, and they deal with Article 6, Sections 12 and 13 on the House side. These are two initiatives that were brought forward from the Representative Johnson for on behalf of Ramsey County Corrections, and they were... They're identical, so other than the House, again, has the effective dates, the Senate does not. So if there's no debate as to the effective date, it would seem that you could probably adopt the House language. And
members? We'll recommend that for Sections 12 and 13, we'll take the House language. And that takes us to Article 8.
Madam Chair, I believe there was one agenda item that wasn't listed that I received a note. It was Article 6, Section 16.
Okay. That's Senate File 660. Mr. Diebold?
Madam Chair and members, and again, these are identical. And this even went down to the effective date, so...
Oh, finally, we have an effective date.
We'll take some of language.
Article 6. Yeah. And Senate File 660. We'll recommend the House language on that.
Oh, I could send it.
Mr. Diebold or Council, Article 8, is that where we're at?
Yes, Madam Chair, that'd be me again. And the two agenda items are found in Article 8 of the side-by-side, beginning on page R2 on the House side. Excuse me, R3, sorry, Madam Chair.
R3,
yes,
and that's Senate File 1157. Do we have that bill?
Is this Senate File?
1157. Do we have that bill?
We don't.
Oh, here it is.
Madam Chair, if
Mr. Diebold.
I could speak while it's being passed out. My I don't have a copy in front of me, but my notes from my review suggest, now I do, that it's identical language, and I suspect the only difference is, again, the effective dates that are not in the Senate version. And that appears to be true based on my review of the document of Senate File 1157.
I'm wondering if the reason why we don't do that is because this came to us as a purely policy bill and they were relying on the default August date. July, August. Is there a big difference for us to keep going with a July date versus maybe reverting to the August date because these are all policy provisions? Technically, if it's in the... Mr. Backus?
That's not on the effective date. There's another difference.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I was going to point out that this bill actually contains additional sections than what we're comparing to, and I should have been more precise in pointing you, because I didn't have 1157 in front of me. There are more sections in 1157 than the two that we're comparing. So you need to go to Section 3 of 1157, which matches up with the House Section 5.
Okay.
Let's finish this one.
Is this the Senator Foley bill?
Yes.
This is mine.
I recall that this bill came to us twice, and the Section 2, I think Section 2 of this bill is in the Omnibus Data Practices Bill. Senator Olson, is that accurate? This is the...
Madam Chair, I think you're correct. I couldn't swear that it's exactly the same language, but it looks like something that we reviewed in data practices.
And then, so that's Section 3 in the Senate file that matches with Section 5, and is that the exact language, Mr. Diebold?
Madam Chair, no. Senate Counsel graciously pointed out that there is a slight difference in the Senate version where the language on the Senate file, 1157, page 3, lines 23 and 26, I believe, offer additional language concerning the Senate appointments and the House appointments and regarding alternate members and be able to serve as their...
We disallow a designee. Is that the difference here?
No. Well, you have
3.25.
No, we're allowing this.
So that would be, Madam Chair, the prerogative of the group to decide which direction.
And then it's Section 6 of the House language. Is that what you were referring to? I'm just trying to find where Section 5 and 6 of the House language match up with Senate File 1157.
So, Madam Chair, on page R3 of Article 8, bottom of the page, House side, the Section 5 starts with Task Force,
mm-hmm.
and that same section starts on page 2 of Senate File 1157.
Right, I see that. And then so Section 6.
And then Section 6 in the Senate file begins on page 4.
Section 4 of our bill. And is there any substantive difference in that?
Madam Chair, I'm not aware of any substantive differences. They look identical.
Mr. Back. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think we can go with the Senate language, so I would recommend the Senate language. It was my bill.
So consensus that we'll recommend the Senate language on these two sections. What about the rest of the other Senate language that's in Senate File 1157? Mr. Backus, can you, where is Ms. Pondius here? I'm wondering if how should we deal with the rest of the bill?
Madam Chair, I think it's a good piece, and I'd like to encourage the House to take a look at it and see if they'd like to adopt Section 1 of the Senate bill.
This isn't me. It's in the data practices bill.
So I've been told that Sections 1 and 2 of Senate File 1157 is contained in both the House and the Senate Data Practices Bill.
It with similar language or exact language? Or?
Pretty identical. And Senator Olson is the chief author of the Data Practices Bill. Who is the House author?
Representative Steinman.
Okay. We could check on that. Why don't we check on that, and we'll give a report to committee members. So we'll put the House language on those two sections. I mean, the Senate language on those two sections. That takes us to, I believe, Article 9 with 1 minute to spare. Mr. Diebold.
Madam Chair and members, if you flip through documents on the side-by-side to Article 9, it's Section 1 on the House side and Sections 1 and 2 on the Senate side, which is our page R1 of Article 9. These provisions permit telecommunication companies to share 911 data with public safety answering points, and the language is identical through paragraph A and B, but the distinction is that the Senate, if you look at the House language, there's a paragraph C, and that concept in the Senate version is amended on to subdivision 5, which is in section 2. So A and B in the House side is identical to A and B on the Senate side in section 1, and if you look at section C on the House side, and then you'll have to look to the right on the bottom of R1 and onto R2 for the Senate version of that concept. The Senate limited, the C paragraph limits the liability of the telecommunications provider in sharing this information. The Senate has...
Mr. Diebold.
Madam Chair and members, the Senate has narrowed the protection that the statute provides to telecommunication providers. As you'll see on R2, it limits it to cases where it's not willful or wanton misconduct. And that's a decision that be left to the members as to whether, how much immunity would you like to extend to telecommunication providers when they're providing 911 data to public safety answering points.
And then the rest of the language, we'll come back to that. The rest of the language, is it substantially similar or the same?
Yes, Madam Chair, the key difference is in the paragraph C, the limiting liability of the telecommunication difference, but A and B are identical, and then it's up to comparing C in House Section 1 and E, paragraph E in Senate side.
Representative Hillstrom.
Section 2.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We'll take the Senate language. That also was my bill.
Okay. We'll recommend the Senate language of the entire Senate File 1338. Representative Hillstrom.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
So it's the Sections 1 and 2 on the side-by-side.
It's all of Senate File 1338.
So it's 839 there.
Okay. Anything else that's not on the agenda that staff has identified? Very good. It's 6 o'clock. Great work.
Thank you.
We did a lot, and we will see what happens tomorrow. Representative Mullery will hopefully come up with another set of things for us to look at. Staff is going to prepare a memo of what we did today that we will all take a look at before it gets sent off to the full committee to look at. If there's nothing else, we are adjourned.